Good Wednesday to you. Thank you so much for tuning in to another edition of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by our friends at Nosler. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Cam Edwards, your host, glad that you've joined us today at the mothership. We are just across the river from the National Harbor, Gaylord National Harbor, where the Conservative Political Action Conference will be taking place. I guess today is the first day, Cameron?
Today is Activist Day. I've been watching the CPAC hashtag, and lots of people excited about student activism. And it's actually, you know, as much as you tell these stories, and I'm equally as interested in these stories about the snowflakes,
mm-hmm.
You want to see the anti-snowflakes, the melted snowflakes.
Right.
Go to hashtag CPAC or hashtag CPAC 2016, and there are a lot of people, because, you know, I lament, like, is everyone on college crazy? And you look at this hashtag, and there are tons and tons of normal, freedom-loving, conservative college students. It's very cool to watch. Even if you're not going, just to look at the hashtag, it's good.
Absolutely. And, you know, and it is important to note that the news stories don't get written about the students who want to go to class and get an education, maybe have fun, maybe meet friends, maybe meet a future spouse. They don't write news stories about those individuals. It's the quintessential man bites or dog bites man story, I guess, right? Because even today, on college campuses, and I think again throughout society at large, the snowflakes, well, this is sort of a mixed metaphor because I was going to say the snowflakes are loud and normally snowflakes are not. But the snowflakes are very loud. They are attention grabbing. The media is like the Weather Channel in a winter storm, right? It's Snowflake Earl we got to cover these stories. But the vast majority, of college students, even today, it's like the vast majority of college students in the 60s, frankly, weren't radicals. They weren't activists. They're just there to get an education. They were there to better themselves. That's why most people are going to college today. Not to tell others how to live their lives. But we will be at CPAC tomorrow and Friday. Looking forward to it. Probably be actually out there on Saturday as well. So if you're planning on stopping by CPAC, you're going to be there. Come by our set and say hello. Coming up on the program this afternoon, Bob Owens of Bearing Arms will join us, talking about some of the big Second Amendment stories from around the country. Chris Farrell of Judicial Watch on the Homeland Security records that Judicial Watch says reveal officials ordering the terrorist watch list to be scrubbed. Huh. We'll check in with Chris about that later in the hour. Selena Zito of the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Next hour, recapping Super Tuesday and looking ahead in the election season. I think this was probably the best results that the organizers of CPAC could have hoped for. Because all of the big three won at least one state last night. Marco Rubio winning Minnesota. Ted Cruz winning Texas, Alaska, Oklahoma. Donald Trump winning seven states. So you've got a split. And all three of these candidates are still in the race. Nobody dropped out after last night. And so this is going to be, again, a very energetic and energized and a very activized, if that's a word, Cameron, activized CPAC. I think the activists will probably still be around on a Thursday and Friday and Saturday. We'll also talk with Selena about what happened in the Democratic primaries last night. This is largely overlooked by a media who I think is much happier talking about what's going on in the Republican primary than they are in talking about the split in the Democratic primary. Bernie Sanders winning four states last night. And again, Hillary Clinton won seven. But this was not Hillary Clinton running the table. And Bernie Sanders still raising a ton of cash. So we'll talk with Selena about that. Now, news just coming in. Washington Post with the headline, Ben Carson to tell supporters He sees, quote, no path forward for his campaign. He will not attend Thursday's debate in Detroit. According to two Republicans familiar with his plans, Carson will not formally suspend his campaign. Instead, according to these two Republicans, unnamed Republicans, he has decided to make a speech about his political future on Friday at the Conservative Political Action Conference in Maryland, just outside of Washington, D.C. So Ben Carson will be at CPAC, did not win any states last night. Meanwhile, you have Mitt Romney apparently says that he's going to be making a major address on the state of the 2016 race, not at CPAC. This will be Thursday morning in Utah. I'm sure he's got his reasons for wanting to be in Utah, but I bet the folks at the ACU, if he had called and said, hey, I'm planning on giving a major speech, you got room for me anywhere?
Oh,
I'm just guessing that they would have shuffled things around and carved out some space for Mitt Romney.
Yeah, you know they're kicking themselves. When I first saw the headline, I assumed that's where it would be. Then I saw Utah. But, yeah, if you're the CPAC organizers, you are offering private planes, caviar,
what
Cristal,
do you mean, right? Fox News says the 2012 Republican presidential nominee will speak at 11:30 a.m. Eastern time from the University of Utah. Exactly what Romney will say was not immediately clear, though there were no signs that Romney would either endorse a candidate or jump into the race himself. Well, again, we'll see. We are now, I think, after Super Tuesday, sort of in that window of opportunity. When candidates who may decide to jump in as independents, this is now crunch time for them. They have to figure out, okay, can we start getting on the ballot in these 50 states? Can we start putting the ground team together? Keep in mind, all of these campaigns, despite whatever turnover they might have had, they have been building their team for, in some cases, over a year now, maybe a couple of years, putting those plans together on how a campaign is going to run in the general election, not just in the primary election. So there's a lot of work that has to be done to put a campaign together. It's not like you just simply say, all right, I'm running, and then you're off to the races. Does take time, does take some money, and it does take effort in all 50 states as you're running as an independent. So this is, again, the time that we might see people jump into the race, although according to ABC News, again, less likely that Michael Bloomberg will declare himself to be a candidate. But who knows what Mitt Romney will do tomorrow in Utah.
Cam, I just looked at the CPAC schedule.
Yeah.
About that time, Senator Tim Scott and then Dennis Prager are talking, so... You know they're asking for different slots.
Right? We just
so unfair.
We just turn on the news networks there in the ballroom just for a few minutes. Let's go ahead and just get that out of the way. Wayne LaPierre will be speaking tomorrow at CPAC at around 1 o'clock Eastern time. We're going to be signing on a little early. You know, normally we're live 2 to 5 on NRAnews.com, but we're actually going to be signing on at 12:45 Eastern time. So that you won't miss a minute of Wayne LaPierre's address to CPAC, and we'll be giving you a little bit of a bonus Cam and Company from right there on Radio Row at the Conservative Political Action Conference. But make sure that you set your alarms or you log on to NRAnews.com, because, again, we'll be live starting at 12:45 Eastern time. Now, also next hour on the program, Julie Gundlach is going to join us from the Independent Women's Forum. Unfortunately, she's going to be out of town, I guess, after today, and so will not be at CPAC, but I'm glad that she's stopping by today. Stacey Washington from Stacey on the Right will join us with a recap of Super Tuesday as well. Valinda Rowe of Illinois Carry on the soaring gun sales in Illinois and the growing number of concealed carry holders as well. In Chicago, you know, violent crime is up. There's no indication that this violent crime is being committed by legal gun owners, FOID card holders, or concealed carry holders. Instead, it appears to be individuals illegally possessing firearms, many of whom prohibited by law from possessing firearms. And the gun control laws in Chicago don't seem to be doing much to quell the violence. The attempts by anti-gun lawmakers like Rahm Emanuel and others across the state to focus their attention on the law-abiding gun owners doesn't seem to be paying any dividends there for the citizens of Chicago. Right now, after 51 homicides in January, which was the most homicides in January in Chicago in a couple of decades, the official homicide total stands at 97. 97. Chicago Tribune says 2016, the most violent start to a year in Chicago since 1997. Police Department spokesman Anthony Guglielmi says the level of violence is unacceptable and the Chicago Police Department continues to aggressively target those responsible, especially in neighborhoods where gang activity is most active. Fox News says police blame some of the surge in violence on gang conflicts and retaliatory crimes, many of which officers say now begin on social media before spilling out onto the streets. One of the problems that we've discussed in the past, and the Fox News story doesn't really get into it, the fact that a lot of these specialized gang units there within the Chicago Police Department have been dismantled. They're not around anymore because the previous superintendent of the chief of police, or the previous superintendent of the Chicago Police Department, Gary McCarthy, said that these were sort of cowboy outfits, and he wanted to get rid of these specialized programs, put these officers back out on patrol. And you've got officers who are complaining in Chicago that, look, you know, we used to be able to, it takes time. And it takes effort, takes resources to develop these relationships in these neighborhoods where, frankly, you know, the cops in the community don't have the best relationships. And so for us to be able to find informants, for us to be able to get the cooperation of the community, we can't just be driving around on patrol and do that. And without that engagement, without that intelligence, the job of the police to, again, find those most violent offenders, those who are not just most at risk of committing violent crimes, but those who are most likely to commit additional violent crimes, that job becomes exponentially harder. And again, you can fix that without passing another gun control law. You can make life harder for the violent criminals in Chicago. And you don't even need to try to justify passing another ordinance that's aimed at the law-abiding gun owners in the state of Illinois. But right now we're not seeing that move from city leaders there in Chicago. We do have a statement now from Ben Carson. Let me just read it to you. I've decided not to attend the Fox News GOP presidential debate tomorrow night in Detroit. Even though I will not be in my hometown of Detroit on Thursday, I remain deeply committed to my home nation, America. I do not see a political path forward in light of last evening's Super Tuesday primary results. However, this grassroots movement on behalf of We the People will continue. Along with millions of patriots who have supported my campaign for president, I remain committed to saving America for future generations. We must not depart from our goals to restore what God and our founders intended for this exceptional nation. I appreciate the support, financial and otherwise, from all corners of America. Gratefully, my campaign decisions are not constrained by finances, rather by what is in the best interests of the American people. I will discuss more about the future of this movement during my speech on Friday at CPAC in Washington, D.C. So Dr. Ben Carson saying that he cannot see a way forward for his campaign in light of the Super Tuesday primary results. Again, he doesn't say the word that he's suspending his campaign, but he does make it clear that he will not be going forward officially as a candidate in the future. And he will not, and that includes, again, tomorrow night's debate there in Detroit, Michigan.
Also, Cam, Ben Carson speaking towards the end of our show. So if we can ask Mr. Carson to maybe push it back a half hour, that would be great, too. Because now he's getting – he's messing up our flow.
Yeah, I'm sure the good doctor will take that into account. We will have a feed, I believe, inside the ballroom, so we might be able to use this to our advantage, and not that this will be the, you know, exclusive home of the Ben Carson speech. I'm sure you'll be able to see that all over the place, but we'll likely be able to cover that on Friday's NRA News Cam and Company. Because, again, there's news breaking at CPAC all over the place, inside the ballroom, where the not just the candidates, but all kinds of speakers, including Wayne LaPierre, will be addressing the crowds. You've got panel discussions, but then out on Radio Row, you've got a steady stream of, again, everybody from presidential candidates, sitting members of Congress, to grassroots activists, to celebrities. Here's the thing. The celebrities that show up at CPAC, they don't show up because they want to be seen. It's not, I don't think, that type of event. I remember a couple of years ago, for instance, Richard Dreyfuss shows up at CPAC. Do you remember this, Cameron? Do you remember that year?
Yeah, and did you see the story recently? He got in a lot of hot water because he went to a Ted Cruz rally.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like he just wants to see the other side, which I think is admirable.
And he's going to get blacklisted for that because it's, you know, guilty of rightist elements, I suppose. That's what Chairman Mao would say. Anyway, so Richard Dreyfuss shows up at CPAC, and he's not, to the best of my knowledge, a rock rib conservative or anything like that. But what he was interested in and what he wanted to talk about, because we interviewed him, was our civic ignorance. He was genuinely concerned, as an American, that we're not, and it's not a matter of us forgetting. I saw some story today about how, you know, we're forgetting history. If it's history, it's not, and you never learn it, how can you forget it? If it happened before you were born, if you have no memory of it, you can't forget it. You're ignorant of it. You have no knowledge of these things. You don't know what you don't know. In the Rumsfeldian term, it's an unknown unknown. And that's what Richard Dreyfuss was really concerned about. What we are growing up not knowing. What don't we learn in school? Sure, we learn that there is such a thing as a constitution, but do we explore it? Do we actually delve into what it says? And do we talk about why it says what it says? We might teach our kids, that the Constitution has been amended over time. We might even explore one or two of the amendments. But do we talk about all of them? Do we talk about the amendments that repealed or rescinded earlier laws, as well as the amendments that expanded our ideas of individual liberty and freedom, as well as the amendments that expanded our idea of the authority of the federal government? And that's what brought Richard Dreyfuss out there. It wasn't so that people could look at him and say, oh my gosh, is that Richard Dreyfuss? He wanted to find those allies, and I thought that I think he was right that CPAC was a good place to find people who were concerned about our civic knowledge and what we are learning about the country that we live in and the government that oversees the security of this nation. So we will see some celebrities there, I am sure. And hopefully we'll get to see some old friends as well. I'm hoping that Rooster is there, Cameron. I'm really hoping that he's let his mohawk grow. Because from what I understand, he wasn't there last year, and he had also cut off the mohawk. So it's just not going to be CPAC unless we've got Rooster.
We do have fingers, though.
Well, there you go. So there'll at least be one mohawk in the house. I brought my Benny Spies Rooster t-shirt in case I see Rooster. I just thought he might get a kick out of that. Anyway, when we come back after a quick timeout, Bob Owens from Bearing Arms. I don't think Bob's going to be at CPAC, but his colleague Jen Jakes will be there. We'll talk with Bob about some of the big Second Amendment stories from around the country right after this quick timeout here on NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler.
Speaking with Jose Morales, NRA training counselor. Jose, welcome to NRA News. We want to talk about the three rules of firearm safety. What are those?
Thank you very much for having me. The three NRA safety rules. The first one, the primary rule, is always keep the gun pointed in a safe direction. Now, what that means is we want to make sure that if that gun discharges by accident, that it's in the safest direction possible, the direction it will cause if the gun were to discharge, the least amount of property damage, the least amount of possibility of injury possible. And it's our responsibility to make sure that we never point the muzzle, which is the front of the barrel, at anything we don't want to shoot, including ourselves.
Okay. Rule number two.
Rule number two is always keep your finger off the trigger until you're ready to fire, which is common sense, but as my mother says all the time, common sense is not that common. We need to make sure that our finger in my pretend gun is on the side of the gun, away from the trigger guard at all times. And our finger only enters the trigger guard when we're ready to shoot, and as soon as we're done, it's removed immediately and always kept alongside of the gun, preferably on the frame.
Okay, and what's rule number three?
Rule number three, always keep your firearms unloaded until you're ready to use them. So the moment you pick up a firearm, you have to make sure that if they have any manual safeties, they're engaged. Open up the action, remove the magazine, visually and physically inspect to make sure that there's no rounds in the chamber, and then you are ensured that the gun is empty.
Jose Morales, NRA training counselor, let's go over those three rules again. Number one.
Absolutely. Always keep the gun pointed in a safe direction. Number two is always keep your finger off of the trigger until you're ready to shoot. And number three is always keep the gun unloaded until you're ready to use it.
All right, the three rules of firearm safety. How can we get some more information about this?
Just check on nrainstructors.org for a comprehensive list of classes, and we'd love to see people take more of them.
Jose, why is it important that we observe these three rules of gun safety?
As I tell my students and gun enthusiasts and budding gun enthusiasts, guns are incredibly safe. We are the ones that are unsafe. We are the ones that make accidents happen. And if you follow all three safety rules all the time, not when you remember, not when you feel like it, but all the time, it is literally impossible to have an accident.
I'm a mom. And just like millions of other women, that's why I own guns. We're responsible, we're law-abiding, and we're everything that makes America strong. Every day, we're willing to use a firearm to defend our families. But the media, we'll never tell those stories. If a mom puts a gun to the face of a home-invading thug and makes him run for his life, the story gets buried. But if she's unarmed and murdered, the cameras will be at the scene before the police. It's time for moms like me to speak out. We are the majority. We demand the freedom to defend our families. And we challenge the media to tell the truth about our rights. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
I'm a good person. I never bothered anybody. But I can't afford a nice house in a safe neighborhood. I live in a government high-rise. Gangbangers and drug dealers walk down our halls every day. My neighbors and I were scared. We called the police, but they can't keep us safe. Some of us are too afraid to even leave our apartments. But the housing authority told me if I bought a gun to protect myself, they'd throw me to the streets. If I'm not free because of my address today, what makes you think you'll be free tomorrow? I marched behind Martin Luther King at Selma. I know my rights. Now I have my gun. I am the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, Chris Farrell of Judicial Watch, coming up just a little bit later on in the hour. Right now, from Bearing Arms, Mr. Bob Owens joins us on the program. Bob, how you doing, sir?
Doing well. How are you today?
I am good. We're getting ready for CPAC. Understand your colleague Jen Jakes is going to be up here, right?
Absolutely. She is either on the ground or on the plane. I'm not sure where she is just yet.
Well, she'll be on Cam and Company tomorrow. I know that.
Excellent.
Yeah, well, you can let your overlords at Salem know that you've been getting plenty of love from Cam and Company this week. And I tell you what else has been getting plenty of love, Bob, around the country are bills regarding the carrying of firearms. So permitless carry in West Virginia is now before Governor Tomlin, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's
absolutely.
It's like they're going to veto it. It has to be said, but the votes are there. I think of the legislature to override that veto if the votes remain the same as they were earlier. Found out yesterday that Kentucky has a permitless carry bill that has been dropped now in the legislative hopper.
Yeah, it's really starting to pick up speed across the country. You know, and I think it's kind of echoing what we saw back in the late 80s. When Florida, I believe, was first with concealed carry, and then the dominoes just started to fall after that. And I think we're getting to the point where we're going to see constitutional carry go that same route.
You know, I hope so. We had a bill in Virginia, but it unfortunately did not make it out of the state Senate, I believe, is where it died this year. But you also have, you know, I think some big news regarding campus carry as well. So the campus carry law goes into effect later this year in the state of Texas. But right now you've got campus carry bills that are advancing in Tennessee and in Georgia. And you just had Governor Nathan Deal speak out this week and say, you know, look, we had the same level of freak out a couple of years ago when we passed our law expanding where folks could lawfully carry. And we had all these crazy predictions that it was going to be horrible. And none of those predictions turned out to be true. And the same, he says, he thinks holds true for campus carry.
Well, there seems to be this belief, and it's a very irrational belief, among some people who feel that, oh my gosh, if we change these laws, crazy people are going to suddenly start carrying guns. Well, here's the thing. People who responsibly carry firearms are going to responsibly carry firearms wherever they are, regardless of, you know, what a sign says or doesn't say. They're just responsible people. People who are irresponsible are going to carry a firearm wherever they go, regardless of the law, and that's not going to change anything either. So, you know, we're looking at a situation where, you know, the people aren't going to change at all. It's the text in a written document is going to change. And so, you know, I don't think that these people really thought about these things and thought about them all the way through. They wouldn't be quite so freaked out. But, yeah, they have Chicken Little syndrome that seems to be trotted out with every expansion of gun rights, and it almost never comes true.
You know, and we were talking about this in relation to campus carry earlier in the week, because when Utah, for instance, passed campus carry well over a decade ago, right, 1998, I think it might have been for Utah, Colorado, with their concealed carry law in 2003, campus carry was part of that. Now, the University of Colorado at Boulder tried to not recognize it for a few years, but in nowhere else in the country where this has been implemented in the past, Bob, have we seen these stories, for instance, of professors saying, "I'm leaving, I'm going to Australia, I don't feel safe here." Now, the dean of the School of Architecture at the University of Texas Austin said he was leaving, he was going to return to his alma mater, University of Pennsylvania, and head up the School of Design there. And there were a bunch of news stories talking about how this was because of campus carry. He's actually come out now and said, okay, you know, that was one part of the equation, but, like, I'm not leaving because I'm scared of these students on campus. I'm leaving because it's a good opportunity. But, yes, I do still oppose the campus carry measure. But there is definitely, even if you want to say, you know, okay, this dean didn't leave because of the campus carry law, we are seeing those folks who are saying, it's going to be harder for us to attract quality professors. It's going to be harder for us to attract quality students. We're going to have people transfer out. Why would this happen in Texas now when it didn't happen in Colorado a decade ago and it didn't happen in Utah a decade ago?
Well, it's not going to happen. These folks are, I believe the term is cry bullies. They don't get their way and they're going to pitch a fit, but when push comes to shove, they're not going anywhere. The students aren't going to go anywhere. And ultimately, nothing's really going to happen other than the fact that predators won't be able to so easily target college students. And let's face it, a lot of college campuses, especially around the fringes, as they abut up against student housing areas and off-campus housing, tend to be relatively high-crime areas because they know that kids are into, unfortunately, drugs and alcohol, and they carry lots of money for mom and dad, and they're easy targets. And so, you know, that has always been the history of college campuses everywhere. It is now no longer going to be quite so easy for criminals in Texas to target college students. And in those rare events that we do have a campus shooting, there's going to be, hopefully, students in campus buildings able to protect themselves, their classmates, and their professors.
Talking again with Bob Owens of Bearing Arms. All right, Bob, we're also looking here at a story out of California where, you know, you would think that they have already come up with every gun control law possible, but they are always looking for new and inventive ways to go after people's rights. So they've got a bill introduced in the legislature now. One bill was approved by Assembly Committee yesterday on a party line vote that would ban the quote unquote bullet button on semi-automatic rifles in California. And the author of the bill, Mark Levine, says that the gun manufacturers have essentially made a mockery of our laws. And if we're going to lead the nation, we need to strengthen our laws to make sure that no one can evade them. You know, Bob, you know as well as I do that the bullet button is allowed by California law, right? So it's not that they're making a mockery of the law. They are doing something that is allowed by the law, that lawmakers like Mark Levine said, here's the rules that you need to play by. Manufacturers are doing that, and now the same lawmakers who set these rules before say, well, we don't like these rules. We're going to change these rules because you're making a mockery of our laws.
Well, you know, California gun laws are made to be mocked, are they not? I mean, we're looking at a bunch of clowns who would love to just shred the Second Amendment, and for that matter, most of the Bill of Rights, in order to tell everybody what to do with every facet of their lives. That's, you know, it used to be that people flocked to California with this live and let attitude, and now you've got these left-wing fascists who have come in, and they want to regulate every aspect of your behavior that they don't like. And you know, you and I look primarily at their gun laws because that's, you know, our professional area of interest. But they do this across the board. They overregulate everything. And so, you know, yes, people are going to try to continue to exercise their liberties the best they can within the law. And, you know, maybe Mr. Levine or Levin or however his name is pronounced should really take a long, hard look in the mirror and ask what he's really accomplishing by circumscribing liberty.
Yeah, well, he's. I think he would say he wants to make it harder for criminals to reload their firearms. Now, there's no evidence again that the criminals are going to care one bit about this gun law, Bob, any more than they've cared about any of the others that have been passed in California. But you know, again, as you say, the people who will actually be impacted by this are the law-abiding legal gun owners who are complying with California law. The manufacturers who are complying with California law, who are now being told, you weren't supposed to be able to comply with this law. This was supposed to make your life harder, and since it hasn't made it hard enough yet for you to be a gun owner, we got to go back and do something else.
I think you've summed it up perfectly. That's exactly how they think and what their intentions are. They're completely against the Second Amendment. They would love to take every firearm, every cartridge, every magazine, and chuck them into the Pacific. And it is only because the courts have not utterly quashed everything they've tried that they're trying this incrementalist approach. They would love to get away with a lot more, and they're nibbling around the edges just to see what they can get away with. And they're going to keep taking bites as long as we let them.
You know, and speaking of that, another nibble out of California. So San Francisco and Sunnyvale had passed their ordinances requiring people, actually San Francisco and Los Angeles have passed their ordinances requiring people keep their handguns locked up at all times in their homes unless it was on their person or under their immediate control. That happened not long ago, Bob, but now San Francisco, apparently that didn't go far enough because now that the Supreme Court has decided not to hear that case, San Francisco is going back for more. And now they want to require that every firearm in your home be locked up while you're there. Unless it is under your immediate control. They're trying to get away from the ruling in the Heller decision that struck down D.C. storage requirements because the justices said they violate your right to defend yourself. They make it impossible for you to use a firearm in self-defense. Here we have another example of another nibble just trying to go right to the edge. How far will the courts let us go to make it as difficult as possible for people to be able to use their legally owned firearms to defend their lives in their home?
It's, you know, it's just another progressive, and I use that term laughingly because there's nothing progressive about progressives. It's just another attempt to undermine core rights and to make life safe for criminals. I mean, that's what it boils down to. They do not want you to be able to use a firearm to defend yourself against their voting base. And it's a horrible truth that they don't want to deal with.
Talking again with Bob Owens of Bearing Arms. Bob, unfortunately, we are out of time here, but I appreciate you coming on the program, sir. It is always good talking with you, and hope we can do this again soon.
Absolutely. Have fun when Jen visits tomorrow.
It's impossible not to have fun when Jen is in town. But we'll do our
best.
All right, we'll talk to you soon. Bob Owens joining us here on NRA News Cam and Company. Chris Farrell of Judicial Watch joining us after a quick timeout. You will not believe what they've uncovered this time around. Stick around. We've got more NRA News Cam and Company coming up right after this. You know him. You love him. Chris Ching is with us. How are you, Chris?
Hey, good morning, Cam. I'm doing fantastic.
You know, I always want to introduce you as Tom Scott Champion, but you're so much more than that now. I mean, it's really, your career has just taken off and expanded. I mean, you're doing a lot of different stuff right now.
Yeah, so one of the main things that I'm really excited about this year is a company called Mason Target Systems. And so I'm an investor and an advisor for the company. And essentially what our product is, it's an electronic smart target system. So imagine an AR-500 steel plate with sensors hooked up to it. You shoot the plate, your shot location shows up on your mobile device, right? Your iPad, your iPhone. Then the problem that we're trying to solve for here is, you know, imagine if you're at the range, you're shooting out at 200 yards, you've got some paper target down there, you shoot, you have to then break off the gun to look through the spotting scope and trying to remember, all right, which was shot number 19 and which one was shot number 20, and
right,
you're trying to figure out, you know, where your shot location is. So trying to make that whole process of collecting your shot data, right, in the mobile app. There's a whole cloud account that you can have in Mason Target Systems, paired with a virtual gun locker. And it reduces the need for a range to go cold. And so no more calling the range cold to go, you know, walk down, mm-hmm, you know, check and change targets. And ultimately, the technology is empowering shooters to shoot more. Right, we want the technology layer to just disappear. It's just a part. It's just something that works, mm-hmm, and you can just keep shooting, and you can see where your shot locations are showing up on your mobile device.
That's actually really cool. And so, is this available now? Is this still in development? And where are we?
It is available today at MasonTargetSystems.com. It's something that I and the founder, Greg Mason, we have a bigger team. We've been working on it for a good 2 years plus. Getting a lot of feedback from the industry, from the military, a lot of law enforcement agencies, and we are really excited to finally pull the curtain back and do the big announcement that Mason Target Systems is here. At a very high level, you know, before I won Top Shot, I was at Google, mm-hmm, right, working in Silicon Valley in technology. And you know, one of the great things about Google and a lot of tech products is that they're simple and easy to use, right, that from a design perspective, you can just give someone an iPhone, right, or show someone a Google, you know, Google.com, mm-hmm, it's just easy to use.
Right.
So if you take that design principle of something that's easy to use, right, bring that to the firearms space. How do we make technology easy to use when you're shooting guns, to provide useful information and feedback around, all right, look at my groups when I'm shooting my pistol. They're all going, you know, low to the right, low to the right, but I can capture all of that shooting data session information. And so making things easy to use for people is something that, for me, I wanted to bring to Mason Target Systems. And again, it's all about how do we make shooting more pleasurable and more useful for people who want to go shoot targets.
This is really interesting. Now, you know, of course, there are going to be a lot of gun control advocates who are saying, Chris, why are you expending all of this time and energy on something like this? You should be working on smart gun technology. You should be working on, you know, the biometric fingerprinting system for guns. But this is... this is practical.
Yes.
This is something that I think is a natural evolution of technology. It seems to me like there's always going to be a market for products that help you shoot better, that help your training, that help you understand what you're doing right and what you're doing wrong.
Correct. And, you know, this is ultimately, I think, you know, we're listening to the market, right? We're listening to what shooters, the problems they have, the challenges they have, the range. You know, we've been talking to, you know, hundreds of shooters, you know, plenty of range owners. And so, you know, for a shooter, right, that whole back and forth of, you know, calling the range cold, it's downtime. That's just, you know, when you call a range cold to go walk down 200 yards to change and check targets, mm-hmm. it's a waste of time for the shooter. It's a waste of time for the range. Or if you're a military or law enforcement agency, it's downtime, right? Like, you could save that time by using a Mason Target Systems target and putting more rounds down range because you're there to shoot. You're not there to just sit around and watch people, you know, change targets.
Right.
Or, you know, if you're taking a picture of your paper target and then, you know, transcribing that into some kind of range log, that's the kind of process we want to just remove, and your shooting data automatically, right, gets uploaded into your online profile.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, Selena Zito of the Pittsburgh Tribune Review will join us, taking a walk on the wild side of the campaign season. Right now from Judicial Watch, want to welcome to the program, Chris Farrell is with us. Chris, how you doing, sir?
Doing well. How are you?
I am excellent. All right, so among the many FOIA suits that Judicial Watch has going on right now at the federal level, one of the suits regarded the Department of Homeland Security and the terror watch list, right? The terrorist screening database?
Correct.
So what is it that you all were asking for, Chris? And then we'll get into what you all actually received.
Sure. There's a whistleblower by the name of Phil Haney, who was a Customs and Border Protection officer. And he had come forward and, you know, initially was a hero and then turned into a goat. Because he had done some excellent work identifying people who should have been identified and terror watch listed. And then he bumped into some attorneys from Homeland Security, the Civil Rights and Civil Liberties branch, who decided to rewrite everything concerning who's who and what's what. Lots of political pressure out of the White House concerning various groups and figures who were pals with White House operatives. And then when they changed the rules, they required that certain information be extracted, removed from watch lists and databases maintained by Homeland Security. And so they were essentially sent down the memory hole. They had to unlearn and undo certain intelligence collection, and you know, it puts the country at grave risk because out of political correctness and sensitivity to certain people who don't like to be identified by their affiliations with terrorist groups, now the lists have these huge gaps and holes in them.
You know, and it's interesting because, Chris, we've seen a number of efforts both at the state level and at the federal level to pass laws that say, listen, if you're on this list, you shouldn't be able to buy a gun. And there have been a lot of concerns, frankly, that, you know, first of all, that's taking away someone's constitutional rights without due process. They've not been accused of a crime, charged with a crime, even suspected of a crime. But there's also that concern that, you know, you don't really know how you get on the list. You don't really know how you get off the list. You don't know why you're on the list to begin with. There's so much behind the scenes that, we're not allowed to see that goes on here, that there is a concern that this could be a very politicized list. And it kind of sounds like what you guys are showing is that it is, in fact, a politicized list.
That is exactly right. And, you know, ordinarily people that either would have been denied entry just outright or people that would have been moved into secondary, which is just what it sounds like, a secondary level of screening and questioning to identify, look, who exactly are you and what are you doing here? Really just, you know, fundamental basic interrogatives to identify who's coming in the country and who are you meeting with and where are you going? Stuff that is completely reasonable and doesn't violate anybody's rights. It isn't an issue for persons who are, you know, they're non-U.S. persons. That this is being, you know, monkeyed around with, played with, politicized. This is the same sort of thing that people saw when language was radically altered and changed in FBI training manuals because they thought that it might in some way insult or offend Muslims. It's the same school of thought.
Is there any indication that this was a one-time a purge, or is this something that is ongoing?
Now, this is policy. This is pattern and practice. The rules have been rewritten. You know, people are, you know, essentially now guilty of thought crimes. You know, if they have legitimate questions or remarks, or people that would go in and try to look up certain groups or persons who were associated with, affiliated with terrorist groups, that information is now just gone.
Okay, now I guess one more devil's advocate question here. I suppose supporters would say, listen, Chris, we're supposed to be doing this. We're supposed to be going through this list and removing people who don't belong there. Why on earth would you have a problem with this?
Because there are people that do belong there, and they've been removed.
That's a pretty good answer, Chris. So what happens next in this case? You said this all started because of a whistleblower. What's happened to the whistleblower?
Well, he was put through the mill naturally, and as many of your listeners will appreciate, very often the process is the punishment, right? You get put through the grinder. You get accused of stuff that isn't true. You have to get attorneys. You know, they try to sweat you. They try to do everything they can to make their life a living hell. This person has now moved on to retirement. You know, this is all about public education. This is about making your listeners aware of what the government, or what, in particular, what this administration is doing with respect to taking civil liberties and civil rights, and really, it's jujitsu, right? They're turning the world on its head in an effort to protect guys who really do need additional scrutiny, or outright a bar. They need to be barred to travel to the United States. But instead, we're giving people, you know, super rights above and beyond what any other person would ever be subjected to.
Well, listen, Chris, again, I appreciate you coming on the program talking about what's going on here. And I know, based on the sheer amount of suits that you guys have going on and the seems almost every day, the revelations that y'all are uncovering, I know we'll be talking again very soon.
Stay tuned.
All right, we will. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
Chris Farrell joined us from Judicial Watch here on NRA News, Cam and Company. So, again, concerns that that list, again, might be politicized, appear to be absolutely founded. Now, we were talking with Bob Owens about this California bill passing out of an assembly committee yesterday that would ban, this is how California Public Radio describes it. One measure would prohibit tools like bullet buttons that critics say are used to evade California's ban on assault rifles. I have to use my public radio voice. Democratic Assemblyman Mark Levin is the bill's author. He says the gun manufacturers have essentially made a mockery of our laws, and if we are to lead the nation, we need to strengthen our laws to make sure that no one can evade them. So what is a bullet button? when California passed its quote-unquote assault weapons ban, one of the provisions was that these firearms, in order to be California legal, the magazine could not be removed simply by hand. You had to be able to use a tool to remove the magazine. So under state law, a bullet is can be considered a tool. You could also use a small screwdriver, you know, the kind you use to fix your eyeglasses. But a bullet button is a button that is recessed within the firearm. It can't be accessed by your finger. But you can use, again, the tip of a screwdriver. You can use the tip of a bullet to release the magazine. This was what the anti-gun lawmakers came up with. This is what they approved. This is what they passed. And the idea, again, was to make it more difficult for people to reload their firearms. The lawmakers would say, we don't care about the law-abiding people, how difficult or easy it might be. We want to make it harder for criminals. And yet, again, the criminals don't care what the law is in California. The people who do care are those recalcitrant gun owners, those legal gun owners, those people who continue to exercise their Second Amendment rights in the face of such opposition by their elected officials. And that's who this new bill is targeting. Those who want to comply with the law. Because the state said, we want to make it harder for you. We want to make it more of an annoyance for you. And apparently we didn't go far enough. So we're rewriting our laws that you're complying with. And oh yeah, we're going to call your compliance with the law, we're going to call that mocking our laws. That's some neat verbal jujitsu, by the way. When you have people who are actually in compliance with state law, and those who are in charge of writing that law say, well, they're making a mockery of it. How so? By complying with the law, that's making a mockery of the law? It's bizarre. California Public Radio says the measure's next move is to another assembly committee. Governor Jerry Brown has questioned the need for stronger state gun controls. He's also signed a couple of them, too. Now, one of the other bills that passed out of committee, Democratic Assemblyman Miguel Santiago's measure that would limit gun purchases to one person per month. He said, quote, and this is the reasoning here. He said, technically a person, after a background check and waiting for 10 days, can walk into any gun shop and buy over 100 guns. Technically. Technically a person could do that. And we want to make sure that technically they couldn't. And we figure we could, you know, confiscate any bank account that's, you know, larger than $5,000 so they couldn't afford to do something like this. But we thought maybe this would be the better way to go. Now, if it were really about stopping somebody from walking into a gun store after waiting 10 days for a background check and buying 100 firearms, which, by the way, if they've passed their background check, they've waited their 10 days, what objection would the lawmaker have to that? Other than, well, that's too many for them to own. But if it was really about 100 guns, he probably would have banned buying more than 99 guns in a month. Don't you think? But he didn't ban buying more than 99 guns in a month. Nope. Miguel Santiago is trying to ban the purchase of more than one firearm per month. So maybe the argument that he used isn't the most accurate one. Maybe what he really should have said is technically a person after a background check and waiting for 10 days can walk into a gun shop and buy two firearms. I mean, they could buy a handgun and a rifle. They could buy a shotgun and a rifle. They could buy two shotguns. They could buy a matched set of pistols. Why on earth would we want to let that happen? I think, by the way, that's far more likely to happen than somebody going and buying 100 firearms, don't you think? Somebody saying, ooh, I like that set of pistols. Hey, you know what? I was thinking about a shotgun. Well, I'm here. Oh, man, that's a really cool handgun. That, to me, seems much more likely than the scenario laid out by Miguel Santiago. But both of these anti-gun measures, again, moving through the California Assembly, we will keep our eyes on these as well as the latest local ordinances in California, like San Francisco's new proposed ordinance that would, again, require all firearms to be locked up in your home, no exceptions, unless they were under, well, the one exception would be unless it was under your control, your immediate control. And what does that mean? Well, the music means we're out of time. I know that. Can't really get a specific definition of under your control because they want to keep it as vague as possible. So it's as legally dangerous to you as possible to, again, try to use a firearm for self-defense or even have one available for self-defense in your home there in San Francisco. Stick around. Hour two of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, is coming up right after this quick timeout.
Speaking with Kevin Neuendorf with USA Shooting. Kevin, welcome back to NRA News. How are you, my friend?
Oh, it's great to be here. I'm doing wonderful. It's an Olympic year, so a lot of excitement building.
Man, oh man, there's a lot of excitement. So a lot of things to talk about. We want to talk about Rio, of course. We're going to get to that. But first, you have a new campaign that you guys just launched. Tell me about it.
Well, it's the Shooting is My Olympic Sport campaign. So one of the things that we're trying to do is rally a community around the aspect of Olympic shooting. So not many people know that, you know, there's 15 Olympic disciplines, shooting events. And so what we're trying to do is gather everybody around this vast community that we have and really get them to rally around our Olympic shooting sports. So, you know, not many people may follow the Olympics. They, you know, they may know of gymnastics or track and field,
right, yeah.
But we're going to bring them to shooting. You know, we can all rally around that. So that's kind of what we're doing this year.
Awesome.
Going to have a lot of fun around it. So we developed this nice new logo. And just trying to bring everybody together around our cause.
I love it. So tell us about Rio. How's it looking?
Hey, we're looking good. We've got several world champions. Of course, we've got the return of, you know, Kim Rohde, a five-time Olympic medalist.
Great Kim Rohde. What a great ambassador for the shooting sport she is.
Yeah, she's
an ambassadress. I don't know. Yeah. Whatever the right word. She's awesome.
Yeah, whatever she is, she does it really well, so including shooting. So, you know, so she's got to make her spot still. That's how competitive our events are. Oftentimes, the hardest thing to do in the United States is make our own team.
Right. It's qualify, right?
Qualify.
Yeah.
Because there's that much depth. You know, Kim competes in skeet shooting. Well, we have a world champion in Morgan Kraft who's already earned her spot to Rio. So she beat out Kim.
Uh-oh, here we go.
So there's two spots, and Kim's in the lead right now, and we'll find out in May if she makes the team, but she's looking pretty good right now.
I'll tell you what, Kevin, backstep a little bit with me here, talking about Rio then. What are, because, you know, this is where sometimes it gets confusing even for me, what are the current the shooting events that are going to be in the Olympics?
Yeah, if you think it's confusing for you, what do you think I am? So I'm trying to explain it all. We got 15 Olympic events. We got five events in pistol, five events in shotgun, and five events in rifle.
So how does the U.S. Olympic Committee determine that, or how's it? Because didn't one of the events that Kim was in a few years ago got changed or worked in? I know they changed the sports a lot.
Yeah, so the International Olympic Committee really kind of sets the table in terms of what Olympic events are in, and they're always looking at refactoring in a whole bunch of different things, whether it be gender equity or how well they play off on television or whatever it is. So they're always adding and subtracting events. So it's determined by the International Olympic Committee, and then they work with the International Federation for Shooting.
So now listen to that, folks. 15 shooting events in the Olympics. So shooting is not only my Olympic sport, but the Olympic sport. It's a big part of the Olympics. So it's important we all get to know about it.
Yeah, there's a couple facts there that are important. USA Shooting has won 107 Olympic medals all time. We've been in every Olympics since 1896.
Wow.
A lot of people wouldn't understand the success that we've had, but we're fourth most among all medals. So if you think of the big events, track and field, swimming, gymnastics,
right,
the things that we traditionally dominate in, We're fourth best among all sports in winning
That's
medals.
Awesome.
So we've got a great history of success.
We're there to take that ride with you guys here at NRA News. We love the stuff we do with you. Before we run out of time, Kevin, how can people get more information about USA Shooting, about this new campaign?
We got to go to the website, usashooting.org. You can also find us on social media at USA Shooting. Let's rally around this idea of shooting is my Olympic sport.
Welcome back. Hour two of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, starts right now. On the program this hour, Selena Zito of the Pittsburgh Tribune Review, talking about the Super Tuesday contest, looking ahead in both the Republican and Democratic primaries. Julie Gundlach of the Independent Women's Forum, going to be with us in studio as well. Our friend Stephen Gutowski of the Washington Free Beacon reporting that record-breaking gun sales continued once again in the month of February. There were 2,613,074 firearms-related background checks performed by the FBI over the 29 days in February, which is a record for the month. Now, it was a leap year, so maybe gun sales were really down, Cameron, and it was just that darn leap day that screwed up all the statistics. And it was probably only like 14 people anyway buying these 2.6 million guns. There aren't any new gun owners out there. Actually, I bet there were some new gun owners included in that number. Stephen says the February numbers bested the previous record set in 2013, the record for February sales, by more than 300,000 checks. In the first 2 months of 2016, more than 5.1 million checks run through the FBI's National Instant Background Check System. Compare that to the total number of NICS checks performed in 2006, which was a hair more than 10 million. So in the first 2 months of this year, we have already surpassed half the total of the total NICS checks of a decade ago. Stephen says this year is a continuation of a record-setting trend which began in 2015. He says February of 2016 now is the 10th month in a row to set a record. 2015, Stephen says, also holds the all-time record for background checks in a single year. Now, again, this is not a perfect gauge of firearm sales. Some of these checks may be because of background checks for concealed carry licenses. Not every state. In fact, most states don't have a one gun per month law, so a single check could be used to purchase more than one firearm. And then, of course, private transactions of firearms in many states do not require going through an FFL either. So it's not a perfect snapshot of how many firearm sales that there were in the United States, but it does show, again, broadly, that interest in gun ownership is still very high. And going along anecdotally with what we've been hearing from gun store owners, fire instructors from around the country where, you know, the classes are full, the news stories that we've seen everywhere from Minnesota to California, talking about the demand for concealed carry courses and the demand for concealed carry applications. In fact, I'm looking at a story here from WKYC out of Columbus, Ohio. The number of new concealed carry licenses rose last year in Ohio after experiencing a drop in 2014. A state report released Tuesday shows roughly 72,000 new concealed carry licenses were issued in 2015, up from about 58,000 in 2014. There were about 45,000 licenses that were renewed last year as well. Now, 72,000 new licenses, 45,000 renewals last year. But again, that's just, in essence, you know, a small portion of the total number of concealed carry holders there. Attorney General Mike DeWine, in his annual report, says that sheriffs revoked about 530 licenses in 2015. 530. Not 530,000 or 5,030. 530. Again, out of just in the licenses issued last year, well over 100,000. Now, there are several reasons, by the way, why these licenses can be revoked. You move out of state, you pass away, you become convicted of a disqualifying crime. So it is not necessarily that you lose your license simply because of a crime. There are other factors that could cause you to lose that license as well. But again, the number of licenses in Ohio appears to be growing exponentially, like it is growing exponentially in many parts of the country. You know, again, 18-month wait right now simply to get your interview with the sheriff in San Bernardino, California. A year and a half. 10 months in Fresno, California. Of course, if you're a celebrity in Los Angeles, California, you've got your own security guard, so you're cool. You don't need to wait. You're all right. Just hang out at the Oscars. Meanwhile, Greenleaf, Idaho. This is maybe the start of a trend. The small town now has some new signs. Welcome to Greenleaf, Idaho. This is not a gun-free zone. Does that sound familiar to you at all? In Pennsylvania, this was last year, I believe, maybe 2 years ago. Comey Township in Pennsylvania had their signs. Welcome to the town. This is not a gun-free zone. Do you remember that story? Signs kept getting stolen for a while there. And when we were in Harrisburg for the Great American Outdoor Show, the individual who came up with this sign for the township was actually selling copies, including the standard size that they put right up there. They also have a man cave sized sign, a smaller size sign. And we were chatting about this, and he said, you know, there are other towns out there that I've been getting calls from, not just in Pennsylvania, but around the country. And he mentioned Greenleaf, Idaho. Now, I think he might have said Iowa to me, but it's Idaho, Greenleaf, Idaho, that have also now adopted this. Kelly McBride has lived in the town for more than 10 years. She says, we are a big family out here in Greenleaf. It's a small town. I think all of us having a gun shows that we are a respectable society. She told KBOI TV, there's a right place for guns. A place that can be used. We should have the right to protect ourselves from criminals and hopefully these kind of signs deter crime in the long run. So there are apparently five ways to get into Greenleaf, Idaho. And all five now have the signs paid for by private donations. KBOI says a city council member said the Idaho Transportation Department needed to approve two of the signs since they were planned for Highway 19, which is a state highway. That approval, by the way, would probably not have come in every state, right? Can you imagine if, I don't know, some pro-gun township in Massachusetts, for instance, decided that it was going to have its no gun, we're not a gun-free zone sign, and they needed approval from the state, or Maryland. Well, Maryland, actually, I don't know, maybe with Governor Hogan, maybe. Massachusetts, though, probably not. California, probably not. Idaho, sure. Greenleaf has about 800 residents and a very low violent crime rate. KBOI says citizens overwhelmingly support the signs, but the city council member, who apparently remained nameless, says that they did have opposition in the past. Another complaint, KBOI says, that some residents have is that the message is unclear. Gordon Bates, a Greenleaf resident, said when they first went up, I actually had to read them twice because of the not a gun-free zone. You kind of have to read that. I wish it was a little more clear. I mean, the sign says, welcome to Greenleaf, Idaho. This is not a gun-free zone. I don't know. Maybe the interest of clarity, you could just say, welcome to Greenleaf, Idaho. We're all armed. But it seems pretty clear to me. City officials, by the way, in Greenleaf, Idaho, says this has not prompted people to leave. That, in fact, this has actually drawn people to live in the town rather than scaring them off. That does not surprise me one bit, particularly given that this is Idaho that we're talking about. I imagine that there are lots of folks who have given the opportunity, would love to live in a community that unabashedly and unashamedly says, oh, yeah, we're exercising our constitutional rights here. And we don't have a problem with you exercising your rights either. You think Alexandria, Virginia, Cameron, you think that those signs going to pop up anytime soon in Alexandria?
I was reminded by our local blog, Red Brick Town, great blog. Every town should have a blog like this. Alexandria was voted the most liberal city in Virginia. So we had that going for us.
Wow.
Which is nice.
The most. And there's some college towns. I mean, you got Charlottesville. It's got to be pretty liberal, right? I don't know how liberal Blacksburg is, but Alexandria. Even over Arlington. Really? Huh.
We're number one.
Oh, congratulations. I think Arlington would like to battle Alexandria, Virginia for that title of the most liberal city.
We just had our local elections here in town. I'd say here in town. It sounds like Tradio. Sorry, America. Here in Alexandria. It's like swap shop. There was only two kind of wishy-washy Republicans. They had lost their seats. So the entire city council, the mayor... this is a very Democrat-rich city, thus the most liberal.
It's, you know, I suppose it's been that way for a while. In fact, it was kind of a... Now, this is not the first time that the city council has been entirely Democrat, right?
No. I think the two Republicans were just a fluke.
I think that you're right. I think
and one of them apparently lived out of town, and it was a complete disaster anyway. So, yeah, it was just, it really was never a real thing.
Oh, my goodness gracious. Well, I'd like to say it's going to get better, but I'm not so sure it is. Not anytime soon here in Alexandria, anyway. My favorite D.C.-based story today, by the way, is this is a story out of Bethesda, Maryland. I saw this at the Washington Post. Just gives you an idea of how out of whack D.C. is with the rest of the country in many ways. But there is for sale in Bethesda, Maryland, which is right there on the border with D.C., and inside the Beltway suburb. There is a tiny house for sale, 315 square feet. It's a really good thing that realtors came up with the phrase tiny house because it sounds so much better than hovel, you know? Hovel's not really a selling factor, but if you can call it a tiny house, brick charmer, 315 square feet, it's one room. It used to be a substation for the local electric company. It has now been turned into a hovel, a tiny house. And it is going for $415,000, I believe, is the going price for this. Maybe it's $475,000. Over $400,000 for a... Let me make sure here. $475,000 for a 315-square-foot former electric substation. And you know what? There very well could be a bidding war on that tiny house there in Bethesda, Maryland. Again, it just one of those little snapshots that just say, man, D.C. is so weird. It is so unlike most of the rest of the country. I realize, you know, in the San Francisco Bay Area, you also have tiny houses going for obscene amounts of money. I realize we're not the only place. You know, a shoebox in New York City costs roughly $2 million right now. And that's big enough for one shoe. If you want to actually put a pair in, you're going to be, you know, probably more than $3 million. But D.C. is one of those places where, you know, you go around to a lot of cities, or even you look around where you live, and most places around the country, we really haven't recovered since 2009. There might be some new shopping centers going up, but there are also a lot of old ones that have closed. And there might be maybe a new subdivision of houses being built somewhere, but there might also be that subdivision that that stopped about halfway, right, and never got finished. There is still a great deal of insecurity about the future in this country, but not really in D.C. You know, you drive inside the Beltway, and let me tell you, things are humming. The construction cranes are everywhere. The condos are going up for, again, relatively obscene amounts of money. Oh, new casino across the water. That's right. Forgot about that. Well, a lot of, you know, I'm sure the liberals from Alexandria, Virginia will truck across the water, maybe take a water taxi, because that's green, you know, and they'll take the water taxi across the Potomac.
Well, you know, Ken, the one thing you talk about these very expensive cities that we have all heard, you know, these unbelievable stories. But the thing about it is here, and, you know, it's kind of hypocritical for me because my wife's a realtor, so I kind of benefit from it. But at the end of the day, you know, the people in San Francisco and New York, they're making their money in the private sector. We're paying. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, America is pretty much paying for the high real estate prices here in Washington.
Yeah.
Because of the inflated salaries and the out of control government payrolls. So it's all just paper. It's all garbage. But it's all of America's bill, really. You know, these other cities can charge whatever they want. It's private, you know, the tech sector or the money sector in New York or publishing or media or whatever. But here in D.C., you know, America's paying for this real estate.
That is absolutely true. Although I think that the blending of all of these various sectors who now are you know, competing and playing in a way that they have not necessarily been in the past. You know, Silicon Valley is right at home in D.C. There was a story I saw yesterday, but it was from last fall. Eric Schmidt, the head of Google, the head of Alphabet, which is the, you know, the parent company of Google that nobody knows about. It's even bigger than Google. It's Alphabet. So he's got this data firm that is working with the Hillary Clinton campaign, doing very similar things that what the Obama campaign had in 2008, crunching the numbers, trying to burrow down into the individual voters and target those individual voters. Again, as with most things, techie described as being very secretive, right? This is not open source algorithm so that every campaign can benefit from these technological advantages. Absolutely not. But Silicon Valley certainly has found many ways to play in Washington, D.C. But you're right. That is still, generally speaking, private industry. It might be subsidized in some form or fashion by the government and academia, but it is, generally speaking, private industry. Here, yes, this is, you know, this is why you have, you've got, A, the huge expansion of government, which comes with a huge expansion of industries that work with the government. So you've got private industry, right? But these private industries wouldn't really be around if it weren't for the government getting bigger in Washington, D.C. And that leads to this, again, this sort of megalopolis that the Beltway area has become. And it's just, to me, again, maybe it's just because when I moved here in 2004, I moved from Oklahoma City, which is one of the most affordable places in the country to live. And so I've never gotten over just how ridiculous the cost of living is and how ridiculously expensive real estate is in Washington, D.C., because I just it's so foreign to me. But the idea of paying almost $500,000 for a 315-square-foot house. And here's the thing. Somebody who probably declares themselves to be much smarter than you, Bumpkin, they're gonna plunk down $500,000 for that 315-square-foot home. And they're going to pat themselves on the back for that wise investment. So, ponder that. I mean, that's about the size of... You could probably find hotel rooms at the Gaylord National bigger than that, right? $500,000. Well, what do you bet the odds are, Cameron, it'll have a Bernie sticker on it before long?
All I know is my wife, the realtor, retweeted your tweet immediately, so...
She's always working. She's probably thinking, oh.
She's working the angle.
Why could I not have gotten a hold of that property? Pitch it to some young millennial. Listen, it's only going to go up in value. Do you know how rare it is to be able to move into a electric substation that's been turned into a tiny house? Do you know what kind of resale value that has, the storytelling that comes with this property?
You know, I know that you and your wife watch the home channels, and my wife watches these now because, you know, the ideas and stuff. And this, I didn't even know this. There's actually a show devoted to these tiny houses. I mean, this is a thing. I had no earthly idea.
Tiny. I think there are several. I know that there's Tiny House Nation. I've flipped past this one. Don't get me started on the tiny houses. There's a whole little subchapter in Heavy Lifting about don't buy a tiny house. Because they used to be called hovels. They did. Honestly, you could go look it up. Ask your grandparents. Granddad, did you ever want to live in a tiny house? And say, no, I lived in a tiny house with 8 of my siblings. I wanted a big house that I could walk around in. I wanted a house with extra rooms. I would want to live in a hovel. But now we're rebranding the shrinking of the American dream. You don't really want a 3-bedroom house. You don't want a white picket fence. You just got to paint that fence. You don't want 2.5 kids and a dog. You know, you don't want any of that stuff. You want a tablet. You want a hovel, and maybe a hovel on wheels. And you want a smart car, or maybe like an electric powered rickshaw or something.
A Vespa.
a Vespa. Yeah, and that's all that you need. That's your new American dream. And if you want any more than that, you're just greedy. I'm sorry. I disagree with that. I think you are worth more than a tiny house and a Vespa and a dorm fridge and a composting toilet. I think you're worth more than that, America. All right. When we come back, Selena Zito of the Pittsburgh Tribune Review, Julie Gunlock of the Independent Women's Forum. Stick around. There is much more NRA News, Cam and Company, coming up right after this.
I'm speaking with Chris Fidget, with the Firearms Guide. Chris, you've got a really exciting, neat product. Tell folks, what is the Firearms Guide?
Firearms Guide is a huge firearms, airguns, and ammunition searchable guide or a reference guide that it's online. Web address is firearmsguide.com. It's a subscription-only website. But it's not only a website. It's a huge searchable firearms and ammunition reference guide that it has its own search engine built inside of it, so all the users can actually search all these guns by the 14 different search criteria, by caliber, by country of origin, by year of production, by the type of the gun. Do I want to check rifle or a shotgun? Do I want to check semi-automatic shotgun over and under shotgun, side-by-side shotgun, or maybe lever-action shotgun?
Wow, that's impressive. So So how did this come about? It sounds like a really neat resource to have.
Yes, we've been developing this for over 8 years. We published 5 previous editions on DVDs, and this 6th newest edition will not be published on DVD. We actually just published it online in the form of searchable database.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So who's the kind of person, Chris, that would use the Firearms Guide? Give me a typical customer.
You know what? Typical customer is any gun enthusiast. Let me say that you're looking for a new concealed carry pistol. How are you going to find? You cannot Google these things. You cannot put in a Google, please show me concealed carry pistol. You press search and you get 65,000 websites. With us, you go to Firearms Guy. First click, you click on the handguns. Then you choose caliber. For example, let me say 380. Then after that, you choose barrel length, because barrel length is also one of the search criteria. So you choose something small, like 3-inch barrel length.
Right.
You want your concealed carry pistol to be light. So you choose frame material instead of steel, let me say, let it be polymer.
All right, before we run out of time, how do you get more information about it?
Please go to firearmsguide.com. Everything is there.
Firearmsguide.com. Thanks, Chris. Thanks for being on NRA News.
Thank you very much. Keep good work.
You critics don't define our honor. You try to shame us for doing our job. You teach children to fear us, crowds to attack us, and good people to doubt us. But we will never back down from our sworn duty to uphold the Constitution of the United States of America. We wake up every day, put on our badge, strap a gun to our hips, kiss our families goodbye, and put our lives between the law-abiding and any criminal who threatens their rights. We serve people of every color and creed, men, women, and children in violent, dangerous neighborhoods. Because they have the same right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness as CEOs, movie stars, and the political elite. We are Americans, and we are the American police officer. We stand with the National Rifle Association of America, and the NRA stands with us. Together, we're freedom's safest place.
I want a woman president, but I want an honest president more. I want someone who can place their hand on a Bible and swear to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution without telling a lie. Someone who believes in the integrity of that office. A president whose actions reinforce the moral lessons I teach my children. There are many powerful, accomplished women in both parties who meet and exceed that standard. But you, Mrs. Clinton, are not one of them. Your past is littered with shameful, dishonest behavior, decades of decisions that point toward your own power and fortune, not the best interest of women, the country, or the truth. There is no greater threat to my freedom than another dishonest president. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
Welcome back to NRA News. Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. Julie Gunlock of the Independent Women's Forum coming up a little bit later on in the hour. Right now, I want to welcome to the program the one, the only, Selena Zito of the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. How are you, Selena?
I'm swell. How are you?
I am excellent. I appreciate you coming on the program. And I really enjoyed your coverage from South Carolina, by the way.
Oh, thank you so much. I always enjoy going to the state. The people are so wonderful. And it's also so beautiful to go to South Carolina in February as opposed to Pittsburgh.
Not that you don't love Pittsburgh, but it is a little bit warmer down there. And, you know, one of the things that I was struck by your reporting is that it seems to me like we have this trend within media. I'm not blaming any one person in particular, but we like our stories to be simple. Particularly television media. We really like to keep our stories simple. This is not a simple election year. And rather than, you know, talking about voters, you actually went and you talked to voters. And you presented these individuals, all of whom had their own reasons and their own good reasons for voting the way that they were going to vote. And I liked it because, you know, these were folks, it made it very hard to see them as an algorithm or a collection of data points.
Right. I mean, I think that it's important to have all kinds of voices when you're talking about an election cycle. And while once in a while I will go to a candidate event, it's very easy to find a supporter of a candidate at a candidate event. I think the real story of why there's unrest and disruption in this country is talking to people in the settings that they're most close to and most comfortable with. And while they may be outliers, they may not fall in line with what either their gender or their party or their race is doing, I think it's one little ripple tells, I think, the bigger story of the country.
And, you know, as you've been talking with voters around the country, what do you think that big story is? Is it the unrest? Is it the disappointment and dissatisfaction with Washington, D.C. and the status quo?
Well, it's definitely that. I've been reporting that for years. But I've also sort of noticed that, and I mean, this isn't a new revelation, right? But politics just hates a vacuum. And especially when looking for leadership. And that's a problem that both the Republicans and the Democrats have had in the past 8 years under Obama. Actually, say in the past 10 years, because the last 2 years of the George Bush administration, he pretty much checked out. So, you know, when there is a vacuum, there becomes a disturbance. People are looking for someone to be a leader. President Obama has always been more about him and the legacy of self as opposed to the betterment of his party. So that's why you have seen these great big historical losses in the Democratic Party. They've lost 913 congressional seats, 913 state legislative seats, 69 congressional seats, dozens of governors. Seats because he has not been about the party. He has been about himself. And for the Republicans, while they've made these great big gains down ballot, they have not had a de facto party leader in the absence of holding the presidency. So what they did was sort of blame John Boehner and they blame Reince Priebus. It's really not their job to be the leader of the party. I often wonder, had Mitt Romney not sort of gone away after he lost, but was there to comment when world events happened or to give an occasional speech here and there, if this unrest would have been a little less volatile?
You know, I suppose we'll never know, but right. I wonder if it's also not hard. It was not just inevitably difficult to be the leader of a party that is out of power in the White House, because there's always going to be that jockeying to be the next person from your party to be the one to occupy the White House.
Right.
And so inevitably, I think maybe there is that vacuum that
right.
sets up. And as you know, it's interesting because while there's a vacuum, you could also look around the country at the gains that Republicans have made over the last 10 years, and, you know, there's a fairly deep bench. There are a lot of candidates, but as you say, there's
The Republican Party is in a very healthy place, and they sort of laugh when people point fingers at Reince Priebus because, in actuality, the dude's done a lot of stuff for the Republican Party. He's raised a ton of money. He's got the party out of debt. He's done a great job in minority outreach, and he's rebuilt the party from the ground up. It's not his fault we have this mess. It's not his fault that this primary season has been crazy. That's our fault. You know, we own this. We're the ones that are angry, and there's nothing wrong with us being angry, but we then can't blame it on someone who's done all the things that they're supposed to do. I mean, when you're in the middle of a populist moment,
mm-hmm.
and populism by definition is energy, there is no leader. There's just energy behind someone.
Absolutely. And in that sense, you know, maybe even looking for fault is kind of looking in the wrong direction because
we have to own it a little bit. We kind of have to own it a little bit. And I know that's something hard for people to think about.
Yeah.
But when you look at the retention rate of someone in Congress, which is at 90%, if we were that mad at Congress, why do we keep sending the same people there?
And what the voters would typically say, and here I go talking about the voters, but isn't the typical response that, well, I'm okay with my representative? It's the other guys. It's the other Congress critters that I don't like. My Congress critters all right.
Right. I interviewed Speaker Ryan yesterday in Washington, and it was I've interviewed Paul Ryan several times in several different sort of incarnations of his career. This is a very principled man who wants to do very good things for not only the party, but as well as the House under his speakership. And I'm really anxious for everyone to read everything that he had to say, because he's a pretty smart guy for a pretty young guy.
Is this out now?
No, it'll run Sunday.
Okay, awesome. Well, we'll be sure to check in and read that. In the meantime, are you going to be able to stop in at CPAC and see all of the excitement this week?
Well, my first grandchild is due, so I've decided not to come this year so that I'm not far away and miss my first grandbaby.
That's a pretty good reason. You know, I mean, really, all things considered, to take a pause from the political coverage, that's a pretty good reason. Congratulations.
Well, I mean, I think people, whoever, wherever you're on the spectrum of this, whether you are a Trump supporter or a Cruz supporter or a Rubio supporter, the trajectory that we are on is going to be messy, and people need to accept that part. And the other thing I think people should remember is, no matter what happens this year, we're still not going to be happy November 5th. We're still going to be disruptive. And this populism streak, this sort of realignment that we're going on, this trajectory that we're heading towards, is not over. I would argue we probably have a few more years of it.
I think that's right. And, I, as long as we're reminding people about gloomy stuff, I think it's fair to say that, you know, come November, not only are we still going to be disruptive and we're still going to be this upset, I think there's, a large part of America that's going to be even more upset, because we're so fractured and splintered that I don't think any majority of Americans are going to be particularly thrilled with Election Day.
No, I do not think so at all. I think that this disruption continues. You know, there was a similar era in our republic that went from, believe it or not, it took from 1820 until 1856 for the Republican Party to form. It took that many years of disruption and populism and fractured parties and different ideologies to finally form, by 1856. The first person they put up, Freeman, didn't win, but he did win. He did, like, split the vote three ways. And the next election cycle was Lincoln. So all of this is not unprecedented, what we're doing. It's normal, but it's certainly not going to be short and sweet.
Selena Zito with the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Listen, I always love talking with you. Thanks again for coming on the program.
Always love being on. Thank you.
Absolutely. Congratulations again. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Selena Zito of the Pittsburgh Tribune Review joining us here on the program. Yeah, I was listening to Glenn Beck on my way up to the mothership today on SiriusXM Patriot 125. He was talking with Senator Ben Sasse, who talked about this being an 1860 election, which, by the way, you know, I think you've heard us reference that maybe even a couple of months ago, talking with our friend Jim Garrity. Here is the thing that kind of concerned me a little bit, Cameron. So he said, Senator Sasse said, you know, this is like an 1860 election, and that's when we got Lincoln. And hey, see, it's okay. And I thought to myself, yeah, but that's when we had a Civil War. Like, it's always look on the sunny side, I suppose. But there was some bad things that happened after the 1860 election. I'm not sure that, hey, we got Lincoln, yay, a wartime president during the Civil War. Not sure that that's the greatest comparison. I mean, it might be an apt comparison if we do see over the next month or so a couple of independents get into the race. We could have a four-person race. Maybe less likely now than it was 2 or 3 months ago. But it's still possible, and certainly a three-person race absolutely would be possible. But
Cam, also speaking of the race, starting to look at some of these CPAC tweets already. There's lots of shouting at some of these sessions. Various fans of various candidates are shouting various things at other fans of other various candidates. So it's going to be interesting.
When you're a Jet,
it's only Wednesday.
Jet for life. I'm telling you, it's going to... Just learn your show tunes, partisan. That's all I ask, is that you make it entertaining as you yell at each other. Just make it entertaining for the rest of us. It's going to be in that big, broad hallway, Cameron. I'm just thinking they're gonna see each other coming. And they're just going to start shouting.
Well, you know, the broadcast row is an L.
I know.
The perfect, and we're right there at the Nexus. So we'll be there for the Anchorman fight.
Right? if you see any Tim Robbins sightings at CPAC, we know that it's because he's not like Richard Dreyfuss. He's not there to lecture anybody about the need for more civic knowledge. He's just there to swing a bicycle chain at somebody's head. That's in the name of PBS. All right, when we come back here on NRA News, Cam and Company, Julie Gunlock of the Independent Women's Forum will join us. We've got the hero of the day, deal of the day, good guy of the day coming up at the top of the hour. Stick around. We'll be right back with much more. NRA News, Cam and Company, right after this. Here at the Great American Outdoor Show in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and we're here with Adam Whitehead from the Sportsman's Box. Adam, thank you, sir, for coming on the program.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
This is a really cool idea. My kids, my youngest are 10, and last year for their birthday, we got them this thing called Loot Crate, which is a subscription box. And I started thinking, man, I want something like that, but I want it for me. Like, I'm not interested in comic book stuff, things like that. And my eyes just lit up when I walked by your booth, because that's exactly what the Sportsman Box is, right?
Right. So it's like it's a Christmas present for any sportsman in your life or sportswoman in your life that, or for yourself, you know, that you can get every month. It's like Christmas every month.
That is awesome. So this is the January box that you've brought with you, right?
Correct. This is our January box. It just went out to our members all over the nation. We shipped all 50 states and Canada. So,
This is representative of like what you'll get every month, right?
Correct. We try to make sure we do have 20 other field operatives throughout the nation. So they help us select gear to make sure that all the gear that we put in the box can be used by sportsmen all over the nation instead of just one specific general region.
How cool. So how did you guys come up with this idea?
Yeah, so I used to be in web design and kind of followed the whole tech industry and what's popular and saw that, Loot Crate was doing it. I saw them doing it and said, you know what, is anybody doing this for us, for me? Because I'm a hunter and fisher myself, and I didn't see anyone doing it. And so I just kind of came up with the idea, built the website, and went to my business partner. His name is Will, and pitched the idea to him, and he jumped on board, and we've been full steam ahead ever since, so it's been a lot of fun.
I mean, and you guys have really taken off. April of 2015 was when you guys started this, right?
Correct, and we were only shipping to 48 states, and then we just had demand out of those other two states, Hawaii and Alaska, that we could make it happen. So
that is awesome. So you've been shipping since July of last year?
July of last year, yep.
Okay, and so kind of walk me through the box. I mean, what are some of the things that you guys have in the January box, for instance?
Yeah, so the January box is more of a classic box. We just kind of we put in the Stanley Thermos. Keeps your coffee hot, drinks cold. It's one-hand use. It's easy to throw in your hunting pack, and it's not going to leak unless you're pressing this button here.
Okay.
So Stanley comes out with some great products. They've been around since 1913, and they have lifetime warranty on all their products. So great item for any sportsman to have, obviously. The Outdoor Edge knife, another great tool. Great for skinning. You know, everybody could use another knife. It comes with a camouflage sheath, yet the knife is orange, so if it falls in the woods, you can find it easy. We have some Gear Aid Aqua Seal, which is some repair adhesive. If you get a cut in your boot, tear in your boot, put this over it, let it dry, becomes waterproof again.
Oh, nice.
Stuff like that. And the Tenacious Tape is a type of tape that you want to keep in your hunting pack. A lot of people don't know about this, but say if you get a cut in your coat while you're out in the field and you need a quick fix, throw this tape over it, makes it back windproof, waterproof, or whatever it was. And then, something we like to do is, as sportsmen, we like to eat. I like to eat.
Right.
And so we
always like to eat too, Adam.
So we always want to put it like a field snack in there so they can enjoy while they're kind of going through their box. This January month was Pork Clouds by Bacon's Hair. So it's pretty much just a fried pork skin, but a lot better recipe than kind of what you find at the normal grocery store.
That's cool. So this is, again, representative of what you're going to get every month, but
correct,
you're going to get different things every month. So how do you find the items that you're going to put in your box each and every month?
Yeah, so we always cater towards the season ahead. So, and like I said, we use 20 other sportsmen around the nation in Canada to make sure that the items can be used by everyone. But we test gear. companies will send us gear to test. We send it out to our field operatives and such. But you can expect anywhere from $65 to $75 worth of gear.
Okay, so the longer you get a membership, the cheaper the box becomes, right?
Correct. If you pay for 12 months up front, you're going to pay $35 a month, but you will pay for that up front as well.
Okay. This is awesome. So how can folks get you online?
You can just go to thesportsmansbox.com. I mean, it is really caught on. If you check us out on social media as well, at Sportsman's Box on Instagram, www.facebook.com/Sportsman's Box, you'll see people posting pictures of their boxes, getting involved with it. It's just a lot of fun to kind of come home, see that Sportsman's Box sitting at your doorstep, say after a long, hard day of work, and you know you're about to get a Christmas present, and it's going to be geared towards your lifestyle. It's not going to be socks or anything in it. So it's a great gift option, you know.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, your first source for Second Amendment news and information. We have the hero of the day, sponsored by AdCorp Defense, deal of the day, good guy of the day coming up top of the hour. Julie Gunluck is still, actually she's sitting, but you're still standing. You have not let your late winter cold.
It's terrible.
Bring you down. I'm so sorry.
Oh, it's brought me down.
It has.
I'm so upset.
Oh, well, I'm glad that you're
cold.
Here anyway.
Well, thanks.
I do too, so don't breathe on me too close.
Because I've been,
knock on whatever this is made of, I've been so far able to avoid SHOT Show crud, Great American Outdoor Show crud, the CPAC crud might
You know
get
what
me.
It was for me? We had a Boy Scout meeting at our house a couple days ago.
It.
So it was 20 dirty little boys. I hope no one from that troop is listening. But, I blame the Boy Scouts.
20 of these filthy little children apparently are never bathed by their parents. Well, I do hope that you're feeling better. And you are going to be missing CPAC, right?
Sadly. I am going to be missing.
You're going to go far away. You're like all the way across the country.
Yeah, I'm going to be in California. So hopefully that nice weather will, you know, do away with this cold. So yes, I'm not going to be there this year, which is sad. I usually go every year, do Radio Row, go on your show, see a lot of friends. You know, some of the guests that are on this show from across the country.
Right.
Sad I'm not going to see some of your other guests. So. Yeah, a little bummed.
I'm kind of sad too. But we're gonna put together some sort of Cam and Company meet and greet for all of the guests and the family
Good.
And the listeners at some point.
I hope so.
Yeah, I think so. So you've got a couple of pieces to talk about. This is interesting. An actual case of bipartisanship in Congress, first of all, right? And it's not like bipartisan, we're going to team up on the left and the right to take away your rights. It's actually, this is good news.
Yeah, there's a bill that passed the House last week. Republican and Democrat came together to ease up some of the restrictions on restaurants that was included in the ACA, or otherwise known as Obamacare. And this was menu labeling. So when you go to a restaurant, you sit down and it tells you how many calories are in your food. Now, some people really like this kind of stuff. I mean, I'm very... I watch what I eat and I like to know the calories. But what offends me is that it's mandated by the government. Plenty of restaurants are doing this voluntarily. And as a consumer, I can choose to go to places that have these labels or not go to places that don't include them. But it is a real burden. And when you mandate that, when the government mandates this stuff, it really does become a burden on restaurants, particularly ones that really, they like to have seasonal or they like to change things up or they like to hire chefs that look at what's available in the marketplace and maybe change menus and specials. And so, so this really was a problem for restaurants. And frankly, I think it was a recipe, for making restaurants, stick with what's on their menu and never changing it because, if they did change it, they put something new on the menu, they'd have to send it out for analysis for the calories. I know I'm going on here, but it also leaves, I think, restaurants, really open to lawsuits. What if you go in and you have a certain thing on the menu and then you think it has more calories? I mean, I feel like people could, sue a restaurant if it's not exactly what is on the menu. So.
Well, I have to tell you what I thought was the most interesting part of your story is the fact that we're basically, Congress passed a law, whether you like it or not, Congress passed a law. And in this law, as you write, the original menu labeling mandate was narrowly written, right? So the law actually said that calories are to be listed, quote, on menus and menu boards in chain restaurants, similar retail food establishments and vending machines with 20 or more locations. So that's the law that Congress wrote.
Right.
But then the deep state, the bureaucracy, gets a hold of the law and says, oh, wait, we think this actually means something entirely different, right?
Yeah.
And so they expanded. They took what Congress had written and they scribbled all over it and said, nah, we're going to – it's going to be something else entirely. Yeah. It's going to be so much more than this.
It is astonishing what the FDA did. So the FDA, during the rulemaking process, the Congress passes a law, then it goes to the agency, and the agency looks at this, looks at the congressional intent, mm-hmm. looks at the congressional language. They took that, what you just read off, that very narrow language, and expanded it to every possible business that even serves. I mean, like, you go to the bowling alley, and they included concession stands. I mean, 7-Elevens. I mean, it's just astonishing to me. I sort of joked in the piece, the only thing they left out was a child's lemonade stand. But give them time, they'll probably get that the next time around. And
right.
So it included so many things. And this it's a real burden on those types of businesses as well. So there's another point that I made in this piece that I think is really critical. They passed the ACA several years ago. And since that bill, that disaster of a bill, badly written piece of legislation has passed, Congress has spent nearly all of its time doing technical corrections to that bill because it was so badly written in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what you get when you have either agencies that go wild, ignore congressional intent and the original intent of the language, or you have a bill that's just so flatly bad. I suggest at the end of the piece, just repeal the whole ACA. Let's repeal the whole darn thing and start over.
That's crazy talk. I mean, but this is, and we see this, we saw this with the New York Safe Act, actually, the Gun Control Act that was signed by Andrew Cuomo, right? And ever since they passed that in 2013, parts of it have been thrown out by the courts.
Yeah.
Parts of it haven't been implemented.
Yeah.
Governor Cuomo tried to arbitrarily rewrite a portion of the law because it wasn't going to work. It wasn't going to stand up to legal scrutiny. And so there is this mentality, I think, of, all right, we'll pass it and then we'll figure out all the details later. But there's also, again, that bureaucratic mentality of, well, we'll take what the law is and we'll make it read whatever
we want it to read. Yeah.
So that brings me to, I guess, my next concern is, so you now have this bill that's passed the House again, which clarifies, specifies what the requirements are. What's to stop the FDA from looking, if this bill gets to Congress or gets through Congress, signed by President Obama, what's to stop the head of the FDA from looking at this and saying, huh, so it looks like they like what we're doing. All right, well, we're just kind of keep doing what we're doing.
There's nothing to keep them from doing that. There's absolutely nothing to keep them from doing that. And this should bother, both Republicans and Democrats. For years, we've watched the authority of Congress go down as we have a much more powerful presidency now. And so if we care about the rule of law in this country and we care about checks and balances, we have to be very concerned about agencies that have no problem overstepping their authority and completely ignoring congressional intent. I mean, this is a little in the weeds, but this really matters from a constitutional standpoint.
It's in the weeds, but to me, this is indicative of so much of what is going on, where, as you say, Congress is supposed to be that body, that check and balance on the executive branch. But the bureaucracy has expanded to the point that it doesn't really have a check and balance. The Constitution doesn't talk about the bureaucracy. The Constitution doesn't talk about the permanent civil service and the power that they ultimately will wield. Right.
Right.
So it's not that we're talking about a co-equal branch of government. In many ways, we're talking about almost a parasitic form of government that latches on to both the executive branch, to the legislative branch, even to some extent the judicial branch, but it's not under the control of anybody.
Right.
And it doesn't have that balance.
Right.
And so I think that's one of the struggles right now, that Congress is trying to figure out, how do you rein in the state?
Right.
Right?
Right.
And again, the executive, I suppose if Barack Obama wanted to fire the head of the FDA for overstepping their boundaries when it comes to menu labeling, then that'd be the president's prerogative, but the president hasn't fired anybody, Julie, for anything, so I doubt that it's got to be over menu labeling.
He's not going to start there.
That's not the line in the sand.
And he's not going to mess with the ACA. I mean, this is his baby, his legacy, and so this is not the hill he is you know, going to die on. He's not going to care about this issue. So,
all right. So Julie has that piece that you can read at capex.co.
Yep.
Over at the Federalist, and we've almost running out of time here, but at the Federalist, you've got a piece. Don't listen to these so-called nutritionists who shame moms with fact-free advice, not fat-free, but with fact-free advice.
Time.
Is there a How do we tell the nutritionist that we should listen to from the nutritionist that we don't listen to?
You just got to watch your sources. And this was a piece in the Washington Post. It looked like, you know, everything. It had all the markers of a good nutrition story. She started out, you know, saying, do kids really need to eat breakfast in the morning? I mean, you know, this is sort of an obvious yes. She gets you going. And then it was full-blown alarmism. The entire piece was basically pushing moms to buy expensive organic food that you'd find at Whole Foods. And you know, this is the thing that gets stuck in my craw. I get so annoyed with these rich women lecturing people in this country about the type of food they should eat when canned and frozen food is perfectly nutritious.
Julie, if your kids are not eating hand-cut steel-rolled oats.
I know. Yes, yes.
You're a failure as a mom,
yes,
okay?
Yes,
let's just throw it out there. I'm not
you
saying you're
no,
a failure,
you don't, and you don't love your kids. That's
not enough to feed them the very
best, right? That's right. I mean, you should sacrifice everything in your life to feed your children the best that Whole Foods has to offer. So, I've just really had it with these shaming moms, and so I wrote this response in the Federalist. I hope this
Julie
this mom
wrote
reads
that
it.
Response while at Chuck E. Cheese. Just to eat.
While eating Doritos.
There you go. Yes. Julie, listen, I hope you feel better. Thanks so much for coming on the
Thanks
program.
Thanks for having me.
All right, hour 3 of NRA News, Cam and Company is on the way right after this. Stick around. We'll be back with more Hero of the Day, Deal of the Day, Good Guy, coming up after a quick timeout. Look what I just got. A challenge coin from Mr. R. Lee Ermey. How are you, Gunny?
Greetings, Cam.
It's good to see you.
We're going to have to quit following one another around like this. Everything is great. I couldn't have written a better script. This is phenomenal.
Well, you look fantastic. It's great to see you, sir.
Feel good. I'm healthy, and as long as I'm healthy, I'll continue to march.
Here, let's talk about Gunny Time on Outdoor Channel. Look, for folks who watched Bill Call and all of your other TV shows, we talked about Gunny Time, I think the last time you were on the show, and you were really proud of what you're able to do on this show, because you're able to do all of the cool camera work, you're able to shoot a lot of great guns. Are you still having fun with it?
It's a beautiful thing when a man can have a job that he can't wait to get out of bed in the morning so he go to work. Isn't that cool? Now, you've
Fantastic.
Got a job, Cam. Come on. You love your job.
I do.
You love what you do. But there are so many people. A car will pick me up and take me to the studio or take me to the location where we're shooting at. And as I'm driving along, I'm looking out the window of my car, the town car, and I'm seeing all these long faces. And these are guys driving to work. They're going to some thankless job that, you know, they actually have to work. It's not fun for them, but they have to have the paycheck. That's the important thing, is the paycheck. But for me, I just can't wait to get to work so I can go shoot the guns and drive the tanks and fly the airplanes. And my philosophy is, if you can't drive it, fly it, or shoot it, we blow it up, you know? So we just go have fun. And with Gunny Time, we have the new episodes coming on, I think that's July.
Okay.
Well, and on the Outdoor Channel in July, we'll have the new Gunny Time episodes, and they're going to be fun. Trust me.
That is awesome. So are you currently filming these, or will you be filming these coming up here?
We're getting geared up right now.
Okay.
We've got our crew. We're pretty loyal with our crews. These guys have busted their butts for us, and they've gone the extra mile, and we've been in snow, and we've been in cold weather and miserable weather shooting, and these guys always right there for us. So I'm loyal to them as well. So we always try to get the same guys back every year. And basically we have the same crews coming back this year as well as last year. So for me, it's like I know all the guys. It's me and the guys. I always work it out where I get to shoot the guns, the machine guns, and drive the tanks and everything. But I always try to work it out where the guys get, after we finish shooting,
right,
we save enough ammo leftovers where the crew can actually come and shoot the guns and actually have a little fun, too. So I think it's only fair.
Absolutely. We do the same thing. When we go out and we do a segment called At the Range, where we go to the NRA range, and we take people shooting. We do an interview.
I've seen it.
Love to have you as one of our guests. But I learned very early on that if we didn't block out enough time for the guys who are, you know, really doing all of the hard work to get to have a little fun and to put some ammo down range, they got a little cranky.
You got to save some ammo and a couple of watermelons for the guys. That's the thing, you know. And we've got some female camera people and crew, and the girls love it just as much as the guys do.
Welcome back. Hour three of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, starts right now. Hero of the day, deal of the day, good guy of the day, all coming up this segment. Plus, we'll talk with Stacey Washington from Stacey on the Right. Get her thoughts on the state of the campaigns on both the Republican and the Democratic side. Valinda Rowe of Illinois Kerry joining us later on in the hour. Any more reports, Cameron, of unrest at CPAC?
A few memes. I saw a couple people post the Brick Tamblyn loud noises GIF. So I think people are trying to have some fun with it. But yes, lots of there's yelling and shouting and good times.
Now, it should be said, there is often yelling and shouting at CPAC. It is an exuberant and a passionate crowd. I'm just guessing that
this isn't the kind of yelling you'd support.
This is the bad yelling. This is the bad shouting.
Bad shouting.
Well, that's too bad. And hopefully, you know, what do you say today? What today was Activist Day?
Yeah, Activist Training Day.
Oh, this is Activist Training Day.
Yeah.
All right. Maybe it's early on in the training. Maybe this is the.
It's re-education.
They're in the do bees and the don't bees section, and this is a don't be a, right?
Which do be you be?
Yeah. Well, we'll see tomorrow on the ground. Hopefully we'll be able to do a show. Hopefully the shouting will not be so loud that it'll drown out those of us speaking into a microphone. On a related note, by the way, in the upcoming 40 Acres and a Fool podcast, you can hear baby goats all in the background because that's what happens when you have baby goats living in your house. All right, let's get to the hero of the day, deal of the day, good guy of the day, hero of the day, sponsored by our friends at Adcore Defense. Today's story from the Philadelphia area, Channel 6 in Philadelphia, with the story of a 65-year-old man defending himself and his wife in Queen Village. It happened around 8:30 Tuesday night, 2nd in Bainbridge in Philadelphia. Police say the 65-year-old man is a concealed carry holder. He's got his license to carry. He and his wife were out for a walk, and apparently two men began accosting the couple. Philadelphia Police Chief Inspector Scott Small says the verbal altercation turned into a physical altercation where the two shooting victims, before they were shot, started to assault the individual that later shot them. They were punching him and caused bruising to his face. Attorney Kenneth Young represents the 65-year-old man. He says the man and his wife walking home from work when the two men in their 20s attacked them. Kenneth Young said his client has lived in the neighborhood for about 40 years, and he has a license to carry. Young told Channel 6 News they attacked him. They attacked his wife. He begged them to stop. He and his wife pulled away. They kept on coming. He explained that he had a firearm. They said, "We don't care." They punched him in the face. The whole side of his face is blown up. His wife is being hit. He asked them to leave. He begged them to stop, and he discharged his firearm. Police say the man fired three shots, hitting a 20-year-old man from Cinnaminson, New Jersey, once in the chest and a 21-year-old man in the neck. Both taken to a Jefferson University Hospital. 65-year-old man taken to an area hospital to be treated for head and facial injuries. The man's attorney says his client is lucky to be alive, says this was life or death. If he didn't do what he did and had the training to do it, I think we would be at his funeral right now. Channel 6 says the DA's office will decide whether the victim will be charged or acted in self-defense, but right now it looks like police believe that this was a self-defensive action and a action in defense of another as well. We'll keep our eyes on that story out of Queen Village there in Philadelphia. Give you any updates as they become available. Our deal of the day from the Herald Mail newspaper in Hagerstown, Maryland. The paper reports a man with a two-decade-long criminal history was being held without bond after his arrest on Sunday in a stabbing there in downtown Hagerstown, Maryland. 37-year-old William Charles Gainey. His address is listed as a local homeless shelter. Charged by Hagerstown police with first and second degree assault, reckless endangerment, and carrying a dangerous weapon with intent to injure. Officers called out on report of a stabbing Sunday 6:44 in the evening. They found Jeffrey Trimmer, who told them that he had been stabbed by a heavyset man named Will, according to a statement of probable cause. Trimmer was bleeding from wounds to his back. He was taken to a local hospital for treatment. He had three stab wounds, which caused a possible or a partial lung collapse. Hospital staff members told police that Trimmer's injuries were serious but not life-threatening. Jeffrey Trimmer told officers that he got into a verbal argument with Will, later identified as William Charles Gainey, outside of the homeless shelter, and it escalated into a physical fight. The fight ended, and Trimmer says he walked to a nearby street where he saw that Gainey had followed him. Another fight ensued, during which Trimmer said he, quote, felt something and then noticed that he was bleeding heavily. A witness told police that William Gainey had a girlfriend in a nearby hotel. That's where officers found him. They also found a knife with what appeared to be dry blood on it in a trash can about a block north of the hotel. During a bond hearing on Monday before District Judge Mark Thomas, Deputy State's Attorney Gina Cirincione said that William Gainey has a long criminal history. Now, he's 37. Apparently, his criminal history goes back two decades. So about the time that William Gainey became an adult is when the state of Maryland starts to see him pop up in the court system. Convictions. Now, not just arrests, but convictions in Maryland for drug distribution, conspiracy to commit to distribute drugs, distribution of fake drugs, carrying a deadly weapon, and two robberies in the state of Maryland over the past two decades. In addition to at least one aggravated assault conviction out of the state of Ohio. And yet, it again does not appear as if the 37-year-old William Charles Gainey has spent any significant or prolonged amount of time behind bars for any of those crimes. The judge, citing his criminal record as well as the possible threat to public safety, did order that William Gainey continue to be held without bail, so he will be in court until trial or until perhaps the more likely plea bargain. We'll try to follow William Gainey's story for you and let you know what penalties, if any, he ends up facing for these most recent charges. But he is our deal of the day. And our good guy of the day from Anniston, Alabama, WTVM, with a story of a police officer there in Anniston who helped a woman who had run out of food. Officer McMichael there in Anniston, Alabama. The police department didn't say what Officer McMichael's first name is, but Officer McMichael responded to a 911 call from a hearing-impaired woman who had run out of food. Officer McMichael is fluent in sign language. Now, this woman doesn't have any family there in the Anniston, Alabama area. She didn't have any mode of transportation, and again, she also had nothing to eat there. The police department said that Officer McMichael contacted a supervisor, explained the situation there, and got permission to take this woman to the grocery store, where she was able to pick up a few days' worth of groceries. Again, not a big deal, right? This is not a story that is typically going that would ever end up on the nightly news. It's just there are bigger stories out there. But to this woman, probably not a bigger story out there. And as the police department analyst in Anniston, Alabama, pointed out, moments like this happen all around the country each and every day. The police department said, compassion is a very important trait to the job that you do. And again, when we talk about law enforcement protecting and serving the community, that service to the community, it appears in a lot of different ways, right? It comes in a lot of different forms. It can be everything from, again, an officer taking time out of their personal life to mentor kids or to coach a football program or a basketball program like the officer in Westminster, California that we talked about yesterday. It can be that officer driving home from his shift who sees something a little unusual out of the corner of his eye down in a creek and stops and finds a car and a young girl injured. And it's because even though he's off duty, he's not really ever off duty. He's always looking. He's always thinking. He's got that situational awareness. He's able to serve the community in that way. Or in these cases. And again, it is not unusual for us to find these stories, local stories. They're never on the national news, but it's not unusual for us to find these local stories of police officers coming to the aid of those who are in need. Whether it is a person who could face an arrest for shoplifting, food for their family when they don't have any food for their family, and the officer ends up paying for the dozen eggs. Saw that not too long ago, right? To officers who help out those who need a place to stay. Saw that with a officer helping out a homeless veteran not too long ago. To stories like this one, again, out of Anniston, Alabama, where a police officer just coming to the aid of somebody who needs help. And they do it because they're in the right place at the right time and because they also want to do the right thing. So, Anniston, Alabama, Police Officer McMichael, we thank you, sir, for being one of the many, many good guys out there. Now, still to come on the program this afternoon, Stacey Washington is going to join us. Talking about Super Tuesday, Valinda Rowe of Illinois Carey will join us on the program as well, talking about the surge in gun sales in the state of Illinois. And in South Carolina, the NRA's Institute for Legislative Action says it is mobilizing members and supporters in the state to take action to pass legislation that would, at the very least, ensure that South Carolina recognizes all valid right-to-carry licenses from other states around the country. House Bill 3025 was introduced by State Representative Alan Clemens last year with the intention, NRA ILA says, of passing a true right-to-carry recognition bill. It faced opposition from the State Law Enforcement Division and the South Carolina Sheriff's Association. It was amended to become a permitless carry bill, which would allow any law-abiding citizen who may lawfully possess a handgun to carry a handgun for personal security without the need to first acquire a permit. The bill passed with a strong bipartisan majority. The House of Representatives also passed, NRA ILA points out, House Bill 3799 during the 2015 session. It would expand recognition of right to carry permits, but only to the state of Georgia. Now, both of those bills, again, passed out of the House last session. They carry over And so they are before the state Senate in South Carolina right now. NRA Eiley says these bills are both viable, and at a minimum, mind you, the Senate Judiciary Committee should work to ensure that South Carolina recognizes valid right to carry permits issued by all other states. So the NRA has sent members in South Carolina an alert asking them to contact senators on the Senate Judiciary Committee, as well as their local sheriff, to urge them to support these pro-gun bills. We will be following the progress of House Bill 3025, House Bill 3799, down there in the state of South Carolina. But if you are a South Carolina gun owner and you've not received that alert from NRA's Institute for Legislative Action, make sure that your lawmakers, including your county sheriff, has heard from you. All right, we're going to step away for just a moment or two, but when we return here on this edition of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, we'll be joined by our friend Stacy Washington from Stacy on the Right, talking about Super Tuesday and a look beyond. Stick around. We'll be right back with more right after this.
I'm speaking with Jim Sapieca, director of the NRA Museums. Jim, there's three museums. Let's talk about that third museum you guys have way out west.
That third museum is kind of a little hidden jewel box. It doesn't get the press that the other two bigger museums get, but it's a spectacular little display case. It's the Frank Brownell Museum of the Southwest, and it's at the NRA Whittington Center in Raton, New Mexico. Now, folks who are really shooters will know what the Whittington Center is, but those who may not be that active, it's a spectacular range and hunting complex that is owned and operated by the NRA. There are tens of thousands of acres out there with spectacular ranges where a lot of different championship matches are shot, in addition to general recreational and sporting shooting. But they also have the Brownell Museum of the Southwest, and they have some great guns there. Of course, that history of that area is just spectacular, going back to the conquistadors. And they follow the evolution of firearms in that area throughout that multiple century span. They also have firearms that are used in the types of competitions that take place at the Whittington Center. And they recently got a spectacular group of modern engraved firearms. There are masterworks there that I have never seen the likes of before. So if you're in that area, and it's a great area for vacationing, there's a lot of attractions in that area, be sure you don't miss this little jewel box of a museum there.
And how do you get to see all the museums online?
Well, you can. We have several social media platforms. We've got, of course, the website, nramuseums.com. And, of course, we have our Facebook page. You can friend us there and get our Gun of the Day posts. So you can visit us on the Internet, Facebook, get the books. And for sure, come by and see the three museums. They're all open every day of the week, and admission is always free.
Well, we are here at the AdCor booth at SHOT Show 2016. AdCor, of course, our on-location sponsor for 2016. And our friend Clint Romachet, you're hanging out of the booth all week long, right?
Yeah, back here with AdCor once again for another great SHOT Show, showing off some of the rifles again and just, you know, linking back up with old friends and old people that it's good to be with.
You know, it's good that we have a chance to hang out and spend at least a couple of minutes together here. I got to tell you, I've been shooting the heck out of my AdCor rifle, and, you know, I can say it's everything that you said it would be, Clint, honestly. I mean, it is rugged, it is dependable, and it is accurate as all get out, man. I mean, really.
I mean, yeah, having you at the range day and you know, finally getting a rifle into your hands, I mean, it just, you know, you can say you can build something that's going to be accurate and reliable, but everyone can say whatever they want. It's when you come to prove it, and actions always speak louder than words, and that's what AdCor has done time and time again.
So kind of walk us through. We've got an AdCor right here, right? This is the Elite A556, right?
Yep. It's our 556, 223, whatever you want it, really. because of our gas piston system, we can go suppressed, unsuppressed, or if you're firing, like I said, 556 or Remington 223, everything's toolless, one button. I can push out, dial my gas in right there so I don't have to break my rifle apart. that it's designed to be very simplistic. Said the thing that's always attracted me is the forward charging handle, non-reciprocating ambidextrous that allows you to stay on target and in trigger in case you have something go wrong. But the great thing about it is just that quick. If we got a lefty that's coming in to shoot right there, and he can, you know, have the same benefits of having that forward charging handle ready to go.
Again, no time-lapse photography here. I mean, it really is just that easy.
Welcome back. Thanks so much for being a part of this edition of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. Belinda Rowe of Illinois Carry is going to join us in just a little bit. Right now, I want to welcome to the program our friend, the host of Stacy on the Right, Stacy Washington. How you doing, Stacy?
I am doing great, Cam. How are you?
I am fantastic. I appreciate you coming on the program. So I, when we'd like to, you know, we talk with guests like you and Tony, who live blissfully outside of the Beltway. I always like to look at like the local paper and see what's going on in your city. And I see the big story at the St. Louis Post-Dispatch here. The headline: video refutes claims that St. Louis police held children at gunpoint.
No.
Have you seen this story?
I have only been paying attention to Super Tuesday on, what are we calling today, Wacky Wednesday?
Yeah.
I'm calling it. But I've actually been going back and forth with friends. I've talked to three of my political friends today, and invariably we've discussed Ben Carson and whether or not today's announcement via his, because I'm on his email list, so I got the email first, and then I saw the Facebook post because I follow him on Facebook, and I have him highlighted so he comes up. He's one of my first things that I see whenever I open up Facebook. And it's, you know, I'm not, he didn't say I'm not defending the campaign. He said, I don't see a political way forward, but, you know, we are going to continue because money is not a constraint for us, and look forward to my announcement at CPAC. And so that's one of the things that we, well, I've been talking about it a lot, actually. So
what do you make of Ben Carson's announcement? As you say, he did not say I'm suspending my campaign. He's not going to be at the debate tomorrow night in Detroit. He's going to give a speech at CPAC on Friday. Was this sort of just the yes, I'm leaving, but I'm not making it official. I'll make it official on Friday speech? Because, I mean, how do you go back? It's not like he could show up at CPAC on Friday and say, you know, after giving it 48 hours of thought, we're going to keep going. We're going.
Yeah, that was one of the very first things a good friend of mine said. He was like, well, you know what happens is, he can't backpedal at this point. He can't blame it on another campaign. He sent it from his own email box. You saw it first. You know, I actually posted a picture of it on my Facebook page just to make sure people knew this is not a hoax. It's not from another campaign. It's from their campaign. I don't see him backpedaling it. I would be interested to see what he says at CPAC. I think maybe he needed to make the announcement because there was no way he was going to subject himself to the debate tomorrow night because they barely give him any talking time. They don't ask him any questions. No one attacks him. Everyone acts like he's just a placeholder there. Up on the stage with them, but not someone that they need to deal with. And so because of that, why would he waste his energy going there? But does he want to cancel speaking to CPAC during an election year where they're expecting record, you know, amounts of people to be in that ballroom listening to the people who take the stage? And it is such an electrifying thing. You've been there many, many times. I've sat in the audience and seen. I remember last year it was Carly Fiorina. I mean, if you want to know how to take a stage at CPAC, go back and watch how she did it. It was so electrifying. Her speech was so fantastic. And I'm sure Dr. Carson wants that moment. You know, it's a great way to end the campaign, to address the largest gathering of conservatives before the election and talk to them about the way forward. And I'm sure he's going to admonish the remainder of the field to stay above the fray and remember that we need to be shoulder to shoulder coming up and after the primary season is over. The primary season is not the end, you know, goal for us. It's just something we have to get through before we go up against Hillary Clinton. And if we damage each other irreparably during this season, how can we then be whole and complete and strong to fight Hillary Clinton? She's already pivoting to the national. Her speech on Super Tuesday evening to accept the delegates that she won, and she trounced Sanders pretty handily. Goodly. Did you hear me say that?
I did.
When I spend time listening to Donald Trump, he says bigly, and now I've said goodly. I should I have to be in the corner for 10 minutes after that because I don't tolerate that kind of, you don't make up words.
I watch a lot of The Simpsons, so I say great googly moogly, but.
But that's actually cute. Goodly? Bigly? No, these are not okay. I want to see us be the adults again. We've always been the adults on the right, and Donald Trump has injected an element of, it's just so nasty now. It's so ridiculous to see Marco Rubio lowering himself to these types of attacks, and it distracts away from our message. We are the party of ideas. We have the better stuff that we're putting out to the American people for this year, and it's time for a change. It's time for the Republicans to take the White House. The Democrats have had it for 8 years. They're running it into the ground. We need to do something. So,
Unfortunately, I think, Stacey, that you talk about the party of ideas. I don't think that the media really. We were talking with Selena Zito last hour and of the Pittsburgh Tribune Review, and I said one of the things that I like about Selena is that most of the media, they want the stories that they cover to be really simple. And the simpler the better, because the audience can understand it. The reporters don't have to spend a lot of time on backstory. Just give us the simple narratives. And I don't think that we're at a simple point in time in American history right now. I think that we're actually at a fairly complex point in time. I mean, you can look at simple things like, yes, it has been since 2009 and the economy has not recovered for much of the country, and people are angry about that. People are concerned. People are frustrated. People in their 20s are getting increasingly concerned that they are falling behind where their parents were at their age. These are maybe simple things, but where we are as a country, the fracturing, the splintering that we've sort of seen on both sides, frankly, on the left and the right, I think demonstrates that there aren't a lot of simple answers right now as to how we got to this point where we seemingly can't stand each other. And again, I'm very curious to see what CPAC is like this year. Can people who have different favorite candidates, can they spend time in a room with one another anymore without it, turning into the shout fest that it is on Twitter? Right now.
Facebook.
Right.
And in real life, people are losing friendships. I mean, as politics was already fractured like this beforehand for me, because as you know, Democrats, that's their first allegiance. And then, church and family come distant fourth and fifth after Democrats, and then leftists and progressives, and then whatever it is they do for a living, and then, family. So I've already seen this microcosm of it being a black conservative, but to see it so widespread between people who are simply arguing over whether Trump or Rubio or Cruz are best, it's a bit disconcerting. And I think some of it comes from the rampant proliferation of lies. It's an opportunity to pivot to the story you opened up with, a video refuting claims that St. Louis police held children at gunpoint. Mm-hmm. This person saw fit to, Melissa Bennett, tweet out that the police pulled guns while her nephew and niece were in the car and held these people at gunpoint. And the video completely exonerates the police officer, who she put on blast on Twitter with his name. But look at the names of the people who are doing the tweeting. White Folk Work. He's the one who said STL family. What do we know of St. Louis Metropolitan Police Department officers Stevens and Garrison? It's stuff like that that puts us up against each other in an adversarial way. I love to remind people, 100,000 police officers in the United States, over 1 million interactions between them and civilians, and we have about, 300, 400, sometimes 500 officer-involved shootings a year. Those numbers they point to a high level of professionalism, and we should be holding on to that because we need the police to protect our neighborhoods. We need them to respond when we dial 911. And when they make mistakes, absolutely, we should be following the law, and they should be held accountable. And that's the way a modern society works. And if we see that not happening, then vote out those mayors and those municipal leaders and, state elected officials, whoever you have to, get rid of the people who aren't holding our public service people accountable. But to demonize these guys and to tell lies on them, thank God for the dash cam, right?
Well, yeah. And so a little bit of background here. There was this claim, as you say, that was made that these police officers pointed guns at a 2-year-old child. and the family in a car over the weekend. Quote, the police yelled at him, told him to get back, told him not to move. The guns were pulled out the entire time. My family was harassed and followed. Modern day terrorism. One of the passengers looked at the police. Soon they were pulled over. They were getting out of church. And yet none of this was true, apparently, Stacey, because, again, when officers were able to look at the dash cam, or the police department was able to look at the dash cam footage, they found out, okay, so the traffic stop didn't happen when the individual, Melissa Bennett, said that it had happened. And the dash cam video shows that, no, in fact, the officers did not pull out their firearms. In fact, the there were no arrests made. There were no tickets even issued. And yet this was the response. And as the chief of police, Sam Dotson, said, quote, this shows the vulnerability society has to social media when an individual who may or may not be involved in an encounter casts a narrative that can't be vetted and there's no accountability. This story is out there. It's been retweeted thousands of times when factually we investigated and there's no substance to the allegations at all. You know, look, and this is an issue. And this is not an easy issue. You can't legislate this. You can't say we're going to throw people in prison for telling a lie on Twitter or Facebook. That's not going to happen.
But you can look at the offshoot of what they did. And this is the part that makes living in St. Louis less pleasant for those of us who are still here, which is 75 people demonstrated outside police headquarters on Monday night, blocking Olive Boulevard for about 20 minutes. Some chanted Black Babies Matter and placed baby dolls in the street. That's the part that's killing what we have going on here in St. Louis. It's a Midwestern city. We're a top 20 city, but not top 10. So we're not a top 10 media market. We're not the biggest thing going, but we're big enough that we matter. And we're always in the news for having the highest level of crime or the highest number of murders outside of Chicago and maybe some other state. So the bad news keeps on flowing. Then we have Mizzou, which has erupted into a hotbed of supposed racism. And, you know, now tenured teachers or not tenured teachers, Melissa Click, she's been let go. And then you pivot back around and you're in St. Louis again with yet another racially motivated story between Black citizens and police. Only this time it's not true. So thousands of tweets for the story that wasn't true. What about the correction? I see Maria Chappelle Nadal, who, you know, happens to not be one of my favorite people. She tweeted out on 3:02 p.m., attention Ferguson activists, this man stated in committee today the Ethan gun down never occurred. So she's correcting the record. But how many retweets will that get? Will it get 1,000, 1,500, a couple thousand? Some of these other people, Dar Baran, baby doll protest, Coac Baruch, he had 129 retweets and 36 favorites when he first told the story out.
Yeah.
He's related to the people.
And here's the thing, you talk about Maria Chappelle Nadal, who tweeted this out, attention Ferguson activists, this man stated in committee that the Ethan gun down never occurred, which, again, it never occurred. There's nothing on her Twitter feed saying, hey, you know what, this never occurred. Right? I mean, like,
no. She just did the one tweet, but this is the problem that we have. And it goes back to, as you just said, this is not a legislative issue. When you have people who are willing to lie to advance the narrative because CNN puts the camera in your face whenever you say you're with Black Lives Matter, then the problem is really bigger and deeper. And it's smaller in a way because it's one person who chose to tell a lie. Other people chose not to verify it and retweet it and share it and make the lie the truth. It's a huge societal issue that we're facing. And just like other bad things that start in one neighborhood or city or region of the country and then they spread, we see Black Lives Matter type behavior spilling out into other areas of the country. And we see the greater society, the majority society of white people, completely flabbergasted and disgusted by it. But what is the recourse? Because any statements against Black Lives Matter instantly turn you into a racist, or in my term, you know, because I'm Black, Uncle Tom, which I could care less about being called that. But the invalidation of my opinion just because I'm Black, or white people just because they're white, again, indicative of where we are in our society. That's how you know we've gotten away from the truth being the truth and honor being something that we all aspire to and all of that good jazz, all that good stuff, the old-fashioned stuff.
Well, listen, I think you're right. We have gotten away from that as a society, and I think that, you know, we actually see this within the gun control movement too, Stacey, honestly, you know, where every town and Cosmopolitan magazine decide, well, look, Cam's, you know, a white guy in his early 40s. Let's put him up as a gunsplainer, right? So Cam's, you know, gunsplaining to young women out there why they should always have a gun. And we'll try to create that meme. I mean, we see this sort of, you know, easy dismissal of, oh, because of who you are, I don't have to pay attention to what you say or what you think or why you think this way or your experiences or your background or anything other than the however we want to try to demographically define you, right? And we will demographically define you in such a way so as to dismiss you. So, Stacey, because you're a black female conservative, well, you're conservative. So, you know, again, you're inauthentic, right? Your opinion doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. And you don't get credit for life experiences that if I were a black Democrat, my life experiences would be validated and they would be uplifted. And some people would say, yeah, she can talk about the military because she was she's a veteran, or she can talk about whatever because mm-hmm. she has that in her background, and so it's an area of expertise for her. And the complete invalidation of things that actually happened and things that I know just because I'm not in the right political box, again, indicative of where we are as a country. And we're seeing it play out. We at least had the high ground the last two elections. We watched the cult of Obama and the way people worshiped him and defended him no matter what he said. Now we have that behavior on the right and the followers of Donald Trump. And I said on my radio show, shameless plug, Cam, my show last Saturday, I think, was my best radio show I've ever done. Every interview, everything I've ever done on the radio, last Saturday was accumulation of it all. It was everything, all wrapped into one two-hour program. And in it, I explained how, although I do not support Donald Trump, I am committed to supporting whoever is running against the Democrats' nominee, which is Hillary Clinton, because she is pro-abortion, anti-gun. She's now come out unabashedly, naked and unashamed, that she wants to confiscate handguns from all of Americans if she becomes president. And she will elect people to the bench who are pro-abortion and anti-gun. And worse than all of that, she's possibly responsible for the deaths of four Americans in Libya and endangering the lives of service members and undercover operatives around the world through the dissemination of classified information through her email server, which was not allowed. It is a felony what she did with her email server. And if she were anyone else, she would already be on trial and on her way to Leavenworth. So she's disqualified from being the president. So I'm going to support whoever the eventual nominee is, even if it's Donald Trump. I had to explain that because people are literally scratching their eyes out trying to get me on one side or the other when it's not about who we're picking sides with on the right. It's about eventually beating Hillary Clinton. And the fact that we can't understand that, the virus from the left has now infiltrated the right. And we're all complicit in what's going on right now, the lack of civility in the discourse, all of it. So, you know, it pains me, but who has time to be pained when you have to continue to beat down the lies of the left? And this is just a new one. I'll have to tweet about this and share it on Facebook and make sure everyone that I can possibly reach knows that this did not happen. And here in St. Louis, there are not police officers holding children at gunpoint. Just something else we need to clear up, you know?
There you go. Listen, Stacey, I appreciate you coming on the program. It is always good talking with you, and I appreciate what you do as well. I hope that I get a chance to tune in this Saturday to Stacey on the Right. Where can we find you online?
It's 971talk.com. You can listen from there anywhere. And I appreciate you, Cam. I love what you're doing, and I love your defense of the Second Amendment, all the books. I mean, I wish I could crank out books like you. I will one day crank a book out. I have to. But until then, I'll just be reading yours.
And I will read it. It helps, by the way, if you have a co-author. That's a good way to crank out your first book, is to have someone else write most of it. Yeah.
Who's going to be my co-author? Who?
I don't know. Maybe we should write a book together.
I love it. Now it's a thing. So now we just said it on the radio, so nobody can back out now.
There you go. All right, Stacey, be good, and we'll talk to you soon.
All right, thank you. Have a good one.
All right, you too. Stacey Washington, host of Stacey on the Right here on NRA News, Cam and Company. Belinda Rowe of Illinois Carry joining us after a quick timeout, talking about the soaring gun sales in the state of Illinois. Stick around. We have much more NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, coming up right after this.
I'm speaking with Nate Posey with Headhunters TV on Outdoor Channel. Nate, welcome to NRA News.
Thank you so much, man. Glad to be here.
Hey, thanks for coming by, because, man, you're running around here busy. You got a lot going on. You got the TV. You got an album coming out. So let's start with Headhunters TV. What is it all about?
Man, it's been a blessing the last couple of years to be on Outdoor Channel and, you know, to have the support of the hunting family, really. And it's basically a reality type show that Randy Birdsong and I, we host the show, and we go all over the country, not necessarily trying to be the best hunters in the world, as much as we're trying to remind people how much fun hunting is and how much we love the atmosphere of what hunting is to all of us. You know, go out to those camps and spend camp with people who you've never met before, and by the end of it, you feel like you're family, you know. So we basically travel all over hunting anything from deer to turkeys to elk, whatever, and do our best to put together a quality television program that people can enjoy and know that we're out there loving what we do.
So it shows in the show that you guys love what you do.
Thank you.
So tell folks who haven't been out there hunting or you know, or thinking about trying it, what is it that makes it so much fun to you and so exciting? In other words, why should they give it a try?
Oh, man, you know, for me, we're in a tough time now, as you know. I mean, the outdoor industry, some of us, as you know, especially with all the different avenues of social media, a lot of times, you know, you get some pretty aggressive people on there that are trying to put you down and stuff like that. But, you know, we're all blessed to be a part of this family, the hunting family, and to be a part of this community. And for me, there is nothing better than the atmosphere of hunting. It's not about going out there and killing an animal. It's about going out there respecting the animals, respecting God's creation, and respecting our rights as people to be out there and enjoy the outdoors. You know, and for me, that's an atmosphere my grandfather, my dad, and all those friends of mine who brought me up hunting taught me, is to appreciate the simple, you know, the simple things of the hunt, and every hunt you go on will always be a success. You know, so for me, I think that you get out there in God's creation and just listen to the sounds of nature. I don't think there's anything better, in my opinion.
Yeah, and you're talking about people on the other side. They just don't understand it because they've never done it. And they don't understand what you just explained so well. I mean, we were talking a little bit. You know, you grew up in PA.
Yes, sir.
I grew up in PA.
Awesome.
And whether you're from PA or from the West or the South, it's so much more than just going. It's great to go out there and take an animal.
Absolutely.
It's awesome. But there's so much more. There's the family aspect. There's the mentoring. There's the camaraderie. It's just part of the lifestyle, and people just don't. And what really upsets me, it's not that they don't understand it. They don't want to understand.
That's right. And that's
exactly
right.
What is wrong with you that you have to do this?
And they don't understand how much of a deep, deep respect we truly have for the animals. You know, they don't realize that hunters and, you know, we're basically conservationists who truly care about the animals.
Yeah.
They can fight it and say all they want that hunting is killing this and that. But in reality, it is truly respect. We eat what we take, and we appreciate the animals, you know, with every ounce of us, for sure.
And that's one of the greatest untold stories that we need to be telling all the time. The best conservationists are hunters.
Amen.
Absolutely. Speaking with Nate Hosey of Headhunters TV on Outdoor Channel, let's switch gears a little bit and talk about your music. What's going on with that?
Man, I'm pretty excited about what's to come here. You know, the outdoor industry has been incredible in supporting me as far as a hunter. But now they're really starting to get behind this music project. It kind of happened by accident, but I've been out in Nashville working with some great folks out there and become friends with a lot of great people out there who are pushing me to put out my first album. So I'm going to give it my best, and I'm going to let it rock here in the next couple months.
So explain what you mean. How did it happen by accident?
You know, a fella out of Nashville just happened to, you know, who works for a major company out there and deals with a lot of, you know, big folks in the country music world, happened to see me playing. And, you know, they brought me out there and hooked me up with some incredible writers who are also hunters. And
that's
we became
cool
friends. And, you know, one of them who's been a major help to me is, his name is Red Akins.
Right.
He's an incredible songwriter, possibly the best of all time, in my opinion, but also an avid hunter.
Right.
And him and I have become great friends, and he's just kind of helped me out with the idea of the music project.
More of that camaraderie, more of that
exactly
community. It's
exactly.
Like, yeah, it's, it, you know, and it's people who hunt and who enjoy the shooting sports. They live the life. They walk they talk the talk, and they walk the walk. It's what they do, and it's what they love.
Yeah.
That is so cool. I hope that you got to get back in touch with us when the music's ready to go.
Yeah.
We want to know all about it. So, all right, so it's Headhunters TV on Outdoor Channel. How can people get more information about Nate Hosey and about Headhunters TV?
Nate Hosey, as far as myself, you know, just my name on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, HeadhuntersTV.com, or we also have Headhunters TV, Facebook, Instagram.
All right, Nate Hosey, Headhunter TV on Outdoor Channel. Music coming soon. Thank you so much for what you do for hunting and all the shooting sports, and thanks for being on NRA News.
Thank you,
we
man. Proud to call you a friend.
Thank you.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company. I believe, by the way, the Wang Chunging seminar will be at 8:30 p.m. in the Potomac Ballroom there at the National Harbor. Everybody will, in fact, be Wang Chunging tonight there at CPAC. Maybe not. We got to see a Rubio Cruz dance-off, Cameron. Do you think maybe that, if they could schedule that on opposite the Mitt Romney speech tomorrow, can you imagine a split screen? Oh, that's ratings gold, I'm telling you. Ratings gold. Valinda Rowe of Illinois Carry is with us on the program right now. Valinda, how you doing today?
Doing great. How are you guys doing? Always good to talk with you.
It is fantastic talking with you as well, and it's great to actually have some good news to talk about in Illinois. It certainly seems like there are a lot of your fellow Illinois residents, Valinda, who are interested in becoming gun owners, who are purchasing firearms, becoming concealed carry holders. In December, according to the Sun-Times in Chicago, the Illinois State Police did more than 60,000 background checks on firearms purchases. That is an all-time record for any month in Illinois.
Yes, it is. And we've been watching that. And also, you know, we've had a record FOID applications, record concealed carry numbers. And I think that, you know, we were in a very different time from just a few years ago here in Illinois, where we did not have concealed carry. The article pointed out that there's, you know, a steadily increased number of gun owners since 2013, and that was the turning point.
I think that's right. And as a matter of fact, you know, it's interesting because it was just a few years ago that Illinois adopted its concealed carry law over the objections of a lot of anti-gun activists in the state. They thought that maybe the city of Chicago should pursue the court case all the way up to the Supreme Court. Instead, the anti-gun activists, the anti-gun politicians anyway, said, all right, you know, let's not go there. And here we are, just a couple of years later, and correct me if I'm wrong, but there are no repeal bills that have been introduced in Illinois, right? Nobody in Illinois right now is talking about scrapping a right to carry, declaring this to be a failure.
No one. Absolutely no one is talking about repealing the law. It's working out really, really well. We've had hardly any incidents at all of concealed carry license holders breaking any laws or having any problems other than just protecting themselves.
So, you know, and at that same time, we are seeing people who are taking advantage of their right to carry. And it's all across the state. I mean, the Chicago Sun-Times did a piece a couple of months ago talking about where in Chicago do these concealed carry holders live? And they looked at the zip codes. They didn't give out their addresses or anything like that. But what they found is that there are neighborhoods in which there are a lot of law enforcement officers living that have a pretty high concentration of concealed carry licenses. There's also high crime neighborhoods that have a high concentration of concealed carry holders. And it's not that these concealed carry holders are committing these violent crimes. It's just that finally, Valinda, people who live in bad neighborhoods can now legally protect themselves and the ones that they love with a firearm, not just in their home, but on their way to and from work, on their way to and from the store. They don't have to live as a prisoner in their home anymore.
We have parents and grandparents who can safely walk their children through gang-infested territories, walk them to school in the morning, and walk them home in the afternoon, and be able to protect themselves and their children or their grandchildren. That is huge inside the city of Chicago, absolutely huge. The article in the Sun-Times this last week, basically what they said, a gun store owner said that probably the largest and fastest growing population of gun owners is women. And we thought that would be the case whenever the concealed carry law passed. It's interesting to see it actually come true here in Illinois like it has in other states, that women who have the ability to get the training and get a concealed carry license, they elect to do so. They go through the process, and they are arming themselves to protect themselves and their families.
You know, and it seems to me we've talked not long ago with a Chicagoland police officer named Eric Iggy Keys, who's also a firearms instructor, and he was talking about the courses that he and his fellow officers offer to the public. They, like many others, Valinda, I mean, they are full up for months in advance. The demand from people, not just in the Chicago area, but again across the state of Illinois, to get their concealed carry license, it appears to be high. Do you anticipate that dropping at some point? Is this a flash in the pan? Is this a fad, or is this the new normal in Illinois?
I think this
I think this is the new normal in Illinois. We hear every day in the news media, this is not the same world that we lived in a decade ago. It's not the same world we lived in 5 years ago. It's not the same world we lived in a year ago with all of the accounts in the newspapers of with terrorist attacks and these mass killings. And people are now seeing that it can happen right here on our soil, right among our own people in our own cities, and they want to be prepared for this. There was a big influx, we think, right after the San Bernardino incident, and we think that this is going to continue because it has increased people's awareness of the dangers around us.
You know, and Chicago is becoming a more dangerous city, unfortunately. I saw a story today that most violent start to a year since 1997, I believe. And, you know, again, these aren't concealed carry holders that are committing these violent crimes in Chicago. These aren't FOID card holders who are committing these violent crimes in Chicago. We know who's committing the violent crimes. A lot of them are ineligible to possess a firearm legally. They've lost their rights. They've spent time behind bars. They're back out on the streets. They're committing more crimes. Is the, you know, the gun control advocates certainly want to use the violent crime rate in Chicago to point for the need for more gun control laws. But I'm curious, you know, in Chicago, Valinda, given the fact that there are so many laws already on the books that don't seem to be working, are more and more residents deciding, you know, what I need is to be able to protect myself. I don't need another gun control law that a politician says is going to protect me.
They're seeing that the gun control laws are not working. They are not protecting the people of Chicago. You know, they went through several decades of not being able to even own a handgun legally inside the city.
Mm-hmm.
And it's taken a while for that mindset to shift to what we called just a few minutes ago the new normal, where it is now a constitutional right to own a handgun. And the people are beginning to go through that process. But it takes a while, I think, to raise the general consciousness of the public in that you're no longer a sitting duck. You're no longer easy prey, that you have options to get the training, get a carry license. Even if you don't go through that route, you can still purchase a firearm, get the training, be a responsible gun owner, and have that firearm in your home to protect yourself with. So I think that's why we're seeing the increase now. And I think it will steadily continue to increase until we reach the levels that's been normal in the other cities that have passed laws like this. It's still very difficult in the city of Chicago to do this. There are no gun shops in the city of Chicago. There are no ranges in the city of Chicago to get your training.
Yep.
So the people, I really, really admire the public, the people that are law-abiding citizens that are going through the process to get their carry licenses, because they have to put out the extra effort because it's not readily available for them in the city. They have to go to great lengths to get this done.
Right. No, you're right. I mean, the McDonald decision was 2010. That struck down the city's handgun ban. But we've had 6 years of the city of Chicago still trying to make it as difficult as possible for people to exercise their rights. As you say, requiring that training that is not offered in the city, right? Requiring people go to a range that that doesn't exist in Chicago in order to become a gun owner, making sure that if you are a gun owner, it's going to be as hard as possible for you to go and continue your education and training and your competency with your firearm. They have bent over backwards not to help people exercise their rights, but to stand in the way of people and their rights.
Right. More roadblocks. They've not made it easy at all. And I have to really admire the firearm instructors that are inside the city of Chicago for conducting their classes and then finding ways outside the city for their students to get the necessary live fire range training that's required by the law. So we've got some really, really terrific instructors out there and terrific citizens that are stepping forward and wanting to claim that constitutional right that they've been guaranteed.
Well, Valinda, listen, we appreciate all that you're doing and all that Illinois Carry is doing there in the state of Illinois. And hopefully the increased gun sales, the increased concealed carry licenses, hopefully that's translated into a growing number of activists as well in the state.
We hope so, too. And we really appreciate you and what you do with your program and helping get the word out about all of these issues.
Oh, absolutely. It's our pleasure. Valinda, thank you so much for coming on the program, and hope we get a chance to talk again soon.
All right. Have a great day.
You too. Valinda Rowe with Illinois Carry. joining us here on NRA News, Cam and Company. Unfortunately, we're almost out of time here. We only have a couple of minutes left on today's program. Tomorrow, again, just a reminder, we will be live 12:45 p.m. Eastern Time on NRA News. Oh, excuse me. I've just been told we're moving it to 1 o'clock. Okay. 1 p.m. now. That makes it easier. 1 p.m. Eastern, an hour early from the normal broadcast. We're signing on from CPAC in order to bring you live coverage of Wayne LaPierre's address to the Conservative Political Action Conference that is scheduled to start about 1:15. That way we make sure that you don't miss a second of Wayne's address. We'll have some bonus coverage of CPAC after Wayne LaPierre's speech concludes. Again, we'll be signing on at 1 p.m. tomorrow. And tomorrow and Friday, we will have full broadcast coverage for you. 3 hours of NRA News, Cam and Company, originating from the Conservative Political Action Conference. We've got some guest co-hosts who will be sitting in with us, including Ed Morrissey and John Cardillo. Kurt Schlichter scheduled to appear as a guest co-host. We'll be talking with Martha Benita from Liberty Farm, Jen Jakes of Bearing Arms, Emily Miller, Jesse Jane Duff of the London Center for Policy Research. Katie Pavlich will be sitting in as a guest co-host tomorrow on the program as well. See, how about that, Cameron? You know, like, if you're a guest on Outnumbered, you're just one of, like, six people hanging out with Katie Pavlich. But if you're me tomorrow, you're going to be one of, like, two or three people hanging out with Katie Pavlich. So how about that? Tomorrow's going to be a good day. I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be a great broadcast. We will see you again live 1 p.m. Eastern on NRAnews.com for the Thursday, day one CPAC edition of our broadcast of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, our on-location sponsor, AdCorp Defense. Have a great rest of your day. We'll see you here soon with more NRA News, Cam and Company.